Representative Burkhardt. Here. Representative Larson. Here. Representative Schwartz. Here. Representative Summers. Here. Representative Walters. Here. Representative Wilson. Here. Senator Dockstader. Here. Senator Driscoll. Here. Senator Hastert. Senator Landon. Here. Co-Chairman Nicholas. Here. Chairman Burns. Here. Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
If you have a cell phone, please either turn it off or turn it to vibrate. I gave that admonition on Monday, and sure enough, within a half hour of mine, I forgot to do it. So the next agency up is Agency 60, State Lands and Investments. Ms. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. We're pleased to be here today.
Could you move the mic closer?
Sure. How's that?
Better.
Okay. Well, I'll repeat myself. We're Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're happy to be here this morning. I'm Bridget Hill. I'm the director of the Office of State Lands and Investments. Sitting next to me is State Forester Bill Krapser. As you know, the forestry division is within the agency, the Office of State Lands and Investments. And so Mr. Krapser will speak to the portions of the budget that are affiliated with our forestry division and that he is responsible for. If it's okay, I will introduce the staff that I brought with me just in case we have additional questions. Right behind State Forester Krapser is Josh Van Black. He is the Assistant State Forester. Right next to him is Amanda Sewell. She's our budget guru. You've seen her before. And behind me is my deputy, Susan Child. Susan has a lot of historical knowledge with our agency. She keeps telling me she intends to retire at the end of the year, and so she wanted to come see you one last time. I've told her that's not official, and she may be seeing you several more years in the future, but Susan is here, too. As you know, we are the Office of State Lands and Investments. Just a refresher, we're the administrative arm for two boards. So our budget has various things in it that don't necessarily look like they always go together, but we are the administrative arm for the Board of Land Commissioners. And so all of our budget related to land management is because of our affiliation with the Board of Land Commissioners. The other board we're the administrative arm for is the State Loan and Investment Board. As you know, they're setting investment policy for the state and also running several statutory grant and loan programs set up by the legislature. With that, I'm happy to start right into our budget, if that is acceptable to you, Mr. Chairman.
Please do.
All right. The first unit that we have in our budget is our unit 101. I always like to start on the table, if that's okay. So I would direct you to page 25. That is where we have the table for this unit. This is our administration and support unit. This unit is the unit that obviously the name indicates they're taking care of the administration and support that every agency has to take care of. So all of our wolves, all of our audits, all of our financial reporting and budget coordination. Important to note, though, in this unit is our royalty compliance section. So those are the folks that are responsible for making sure we are collecting all of the royalty that we are due, and they are auditing companies for royalty compliance. This budget, or this unit, has a standard budget of $4,546,721. That was recommended by the governor. We do have one exception request in this unit. That would be in the item 242. And this would be our computer equipment and software exception request. That request is for $57,871. And that would be to replace the equipment on our normal agency rotation. But included in that, of course, is software and licensing that we would need for the year. The governor does recommend that exception request, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Questions? That exception request is on page 36.
I'm sorry. The narrative for that exception request begins on page 23.
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong exception request. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. The narrative begins on page 23 and carries over onto page 24.
Right. Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Bridget, just kind of a general thing on FTEs. Has over the course of the budget cuts, how many FTEs have you dropped in your agency, and then how many in admin, if any?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, we have dropped two employees through the course of the budget cuts. Those are not in admin. Those are over in our forestry division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And Bridget, just remind us, on, over the course of the last 2.5 years, what has been the overall impact of the penny plan and the other reductions? I mean, what percentage are you at in terms of, as compared to other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Nicholas, I have that number. It's not right off the top of my head in my head, but I brought it with me. So through our agency reductions over the last 2.5 years, I don't have that as a percentage, but overall our budget has decreased by $13,519,315.
That's agency-wide?
That's agency-wide, Mr. Chairman.
And can you just give us a breakdown of what that consists of?
For sure. Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Nicholas, it consists of, it is all over the map for us. So generally, it's come in a variety of ways. Obviously, the travel, all of the what you requested for us. In-state travel, out-of-state travel, we decreased our vehicles that we had. We reduced the two positions out of forestry. We also reduced, if you will recall, the one that we did last year was a reduction to drinking water program. You'll remember we had the problem in the drinking water program, so there was that reduction. There was also reductions to our weed and pest budget. There was also reductions to our trust preservation and enhancement account budget. And then, of course, supplies fall in that. And our fire budget was also reduced.
And, Mr. Co-Chair, for the Section 320s, what's your total, any additional in this budget?
Mr. Crapser will address that. We do have a 320 recommendation, and that falls in Mr. Crapser's budget.
Okay. And what was the total requested by the governor, and did you meet it, is the question?
Mr. Chairman, the total requested by the governor, help me with the number, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, the total requested by the governor was $189,000 for the entire agency. Looking at where we had done cuts in the last couple of years, people were the only place we could go, even potentially to meet those cuts. So the 320 that we came up with, I think, was $230,000, which the governor did not recommend in his budget.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
All right, Mr. Chairman, if there are no further questions in 101, I will move to 102. 102, again, I start at the table. Our budget for Unit 102 is our trust land management budget. That budget unit takes care of all the things that you would think about for trust land management. They're taking care of all our surface leasing, all our mineral leasing, our trust preservation and enhancement program, our acquisitions and exchanges, and our weed and pest program. The budget, the standard budget we have for this unit is $3,144,236. The governor does recommend that budget. We do have three exception requests in this unit, and if it's okay, I will go through each of those. The first, which would be our priority two exception request, and the narrative for this begins.
Bridget, if I could interrupt you. When you're going through these, could you also refer a page?
For sure.
Not only for us here, but there are people on the Internet listening.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so the priorities that I was going to turn to, the narrative, that page number that narrative starts on is page 35. And this would be our exception request asking for additional funds for our surface land asset management system. We call it SLAMS. That's what the acronym turns out to be. And this would be for licensing and maintenance and support for the system that we have built. Our request is for $359,270. Now, you've heard a lot, I think, in the recent history about what we were trying to do with our computer system. If you'll recall, it's been a long slog for us, for this computer system. It started the movement to get us electronically savvy and able to use electronic databases for our agency began back in 2005 when there was a legislative task force that looked at the Office of State Lands and Investments and did an assessment and said, one of the things you really need to focus on is making sure that all of your business processes, all of the things that you do are electronic. Then in 2009, we were under a management audit committee audit for, again, our land side of the Office of State Lands and Investments. And that audit also directed us specifically to focus on fully committing to enhanced electronic business processes and all of our Board of Land Commissioners functions. And we've done that. And I know it sounds like a long time ago to mention 2009, but it's taken us that long. Now, when we started that, what we ended up with was several different databases, and they were just accessed databases at the time for our functions. And what we had determined over time that meant was those databases did not communicate with each other. So while they were electronic, we weren't seeing any efficiencies from going that route. It was basically the same as having a paper file, only you went to the computer to look at it. So as you know, over the last few bienniums, we came to you with requests to build a system that would allow us to have in one place all of the information we would need for our surface asset management. And we have now built that system. And I don't want to gush about it, but we're pretty excited about it. It's been something tremendous to see. I won't tell you all the details about it, but the things that I see for it that are really helpful are we are able to look at one land unit, so any particular parcel of land that we own, and look within that system and see all of the uses on that system. And so we are able to now efficiently take care of our land, see what's going on, and manage it more efficiently. This system also helps us with, it automatically generates our bills, which is something we had to do by hand. It automatically generates our reports for us. It automatically generates the reports of where the revenue needs to go, because obviously we have a lot of funds that we need to send that revenue to. But one of the important things for us is we've got every employee in our office now able to use that system, and it touches every employee where that wasn't the case before. We had all these individualized databases, maybe on somebody's computer, but not on other people's. Everybody in our office is able to see what happens with this system. We were able to combine three systems into one, our surface system, our forestry, for finally, over all these years that forestry and state lands have been one agencies, our systems never talk to each other. So finally, we're able to have forestry integrate with state lands. So surface system, our forestry system, and we've used time tracking in there. And time tracking, you think, sounds small, but time tracking for us is somewhat tricky related to the forestry aspect. Time tracking for fire to make sure that we're adequately reimbursed from the federal government is somewhat tricky. And so this is something that the system will be able to help us with. And so that's the system. Now that we have everybody on it and it's built, oh, the one thing I also forgot to mention that I think is very important, this system allows an increased user interface from the constituents. So for the first time ever, and we're in final testing on this, we will be able to accept online payments for grazing leases, temporary use permit, anything that folks would be able to pay the Office of State Lands and Investments, we will be able to accept online payments for the first time.
Sounds like you might be able to reduce staff. You get all
that. That was actually going to be my question between all these is with all the new convenience and cross-referencing is where's, you know, it all makes sense, but where's the savings?
Mr. Chairman, and, you know, fair enough. I understand what the question is. Well, could you cut all your staff? Here's what I think the issue is.
Well, no, keep Susan.
7 years. We've got her locked in for 7 more years. I think what I would say, my response to that would be, you know, at this point in time, prior to this system, what we were merely doing is treading water. We were taking care of the paper that came across our desk and nothing else. We were not looking for the opportunities that you all ask us to look for to generate more revenue. And so we're freeing up time to be able to do that. We're freeing up time to process more special use leases, which is where I think our big revenue potential is right now. We're freeing up individuals that can help us find ways to use our land better, manage it better for better revenue. And so do you see me saying we should cut employees at the same time? You do not, sir.
We'll trade revenue for employees.
So, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Nicholas, that is the efficiency we're gaining, is our ability to do more and generate more revenue with the same employees that we have now.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And on your maintenance agreement contracts, what's the inflation rate on your maintenance agreement contracts per year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, in our SLAMS contract, we did not agree to a specific percentage. We believed that it would be better for us to not include a percentage and negotiate that as the contracts came up, recognizing that we want to make sure that we're getting something additional for that additional money. A lot of the contracts you see have a 7% escalator for every year. We don't have that in our contract with them. We intend to negotiate that every time and be sticklers about it, frankly.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, but you've signed you've got a number in here for a maintenance contract, and you had one that previously cost you X number of dollars. So what is the inflationary increase? And it kind of goes to, yeah, it's great to have these fun, fancy systems, but in the end, we're paying for it.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, in this instance, the difference in how we came up with this number was our old system, or the contract we had with them before the system was fully built and before we had every employee on it, only had allowed, let me get the exact number here for you, 16 people. Only 16 people in our agency were able to use that system for that dollar amount. So the increase now, as I was explaining with the beauty of the system, is we can get every employee on it. It came with adding all of our employees to that system. And that's how we came up with that number. We divided it by the number of users, and we're adding users. And that's why the increased licensing in this instance.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure maybe I'm not understanding, but what did you pay before for your, because you had an old, I understand, okay, you got more employees on it. What did you pay before and what are you paying now for a maintenance contract on this system, and then what are you paying now? So what is the difference in that cost?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, if you look back on the table, which is page 42, so we're in maintenance contracts, budget line item 292. That 178,434, that's the amount it would cost us to have those 16 users on our system now. And so the increase, the exception request, gets all of our agency, our 98 employees, onto that system.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bridget, so this contract is good for 2 years, 5 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, we have not put a specific termination date in there. It would be terminatable, if I've used the right word. Terminable? We can, each party can terminate it on 30 days notice. And so the important thing for us, if I can add to that, is that we own this system. One of the things that became very important to us, and you heard us in past sessions tell you, we didn't own our last system. We didn't own what to do with that. So we wouldn't have the licensing and the support from them, but we would own that system.
So follow up, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little confused now because this contract is for maintenance and support of the SLAM system, if I understand correct.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct.
And so then there's not an escalator built in. This existing contract, that would be renegotiated when you renegotiated the contract, but I don't know how long the contract's for.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, what we do know is this. So thank you for that, the opportunity to explain that. We definitely have a term within our contract. When we add users, we have to add increased licensing, and that's what we're doing here. So it doesn't have a specific termination date, but we definitely have in there, when we add users and need more licensing for the system, we do have to increase the price that we pay to have those additional licenses. Have I answered your question, sir?
You did.
Okay.
You. Please continue.
All right. So I will.
We're going to move on to the second exception request.
I was indeed. Thank you. The second exception request that you will see from us, the narrative for that starts on page 36. And this is then a request for an enhancement to the very system we were talking about. This would add features to our system that are not there now. The most important, and we've described it in here, would be a full interface with our leasing and royalty compliance system. So when I talk about SLAMs, SLAMs shows surface uses and land units. And it will definitely show if there is a mineral lease on that parcel, but what it doesn't do is fully integrate with our leasing and royalty compliance system, so they talk to each other. So when we went to generate reports, for instance, we were asked for a report actually from Mr. Richards in the middle of the summer about our UW land. This is just an example I would I would like to give.
He's wild that way.
He is. He's crazy. The things that, in a good way, I meant, I was just adding on, I'm sorry. I have the utmost respect for Mr. Richards, so that was not intended as something contrary to that. I have a great admiration for Mr. Richards.
How much are we cutting this division?
Mr. Chairman, but what we were able to do, so if you had asked us, and what part of his request was, what revenue do we generate off all of our UW parcels, and can you put that on a parcel by parcel basis? Now, that's something we'd never been able to do in the past, I will say, without a significant effort. When we were able to do this, we were able to turn it around in about a week. And some of the holdup, though, was the revenue from surface is in SLAMs, and the revenue from mineral leasing is in LARCs. And so while SLAMs would show us the use and that there was a mineral use in there, they don't talk to each other yet to be able to generate one full report. So one of the enhancements we're asking for here is the $200,000 would help us integrate those two systems so they at least talk to each other. So now when you go to the one parcel, the land unit that we have, you are able to generate reports both for surface revenue and for mineral revenue at one time. And
is,
that,
is this one-time funding or ongoing?
Mr. Chairman, this would be one-time funding.
Okay.
Because these would.
In that regard, Mr. Co-Chair, on the 359, on the licensing agreements, how much of that will be one time and how much of that will be ongoing?
I have that number as well. It's not firm in my head, but let me get it for you. Mr. Chairman, Co-Representative Nicholas, the 359 would be all ongoing because that would be continued licensing. So that wouldn't be one-time funding.
So roughly to maintain that ongoing system in the contracts, it's going to be $175,000 a year.
Can you repeat your question, sir?
So the total cost of that ongoing system, that 359 is a biennial number, so it'll be $178,000 a year.
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct. That would allow us the licensing, correct.
And have you cross-compared this for other costs, and is it reasonable? Is it does the cost make sense for what the program is doing, providing the biggest bang for the buck for the state, for everybody else? Is there a way that you can charge access fees to anyone that, you know, if they want to do something in depth, you can charge $5 or $10 for someone that gets on and looks? I mean, are there ways that, I mean, just walk us through what your thought process is, if you have, on just the overall efficiencies and need for it.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Nicholas, we do think we're getting a great bang for our buck. When we originally decided the contractor to go with, and the things that they could do, we did an in-depth analysis. So we first started in-house, wondering if that was something ETS could do for us. We were informed that that wasn't really something ETS could do with us, and that we should seek the help of an outside vendor. And we did that. And we chose Salesforce and their associate Vertiba. And when we looked at all of those, and we did look at other systems, I'm getting a little remote in time that I can't remember the other ones specifically that we looked at, but we did think that one would give us the most bang for our buck. And we do think we're getting a good value for that dollar. The one thing that I really like about this, when I think about getting a good bang for our dollar, is what one of the things that we negotiated with them, while we do have to pay increased licensing for increased users, we do not have to pay increased licensing for all of the things that we add. So we talk about possibly adding an additional, let's say we wanted an additional module in there, and because they're very helpful to us and user-friendly, we have discovered folks in our own office that could help us build modules that might that can then be within that system. So one might be easements, right? We could have a specific separate page for easements. I'm just grabbing an example here that might work for us. Our licensing would not increase for including a new module for easements. The licensing is based on the number of users, and that's something very attractive to me, because as time goes on and as land uses change, there may be a need for additional modules or things that we would like to use in there. And it does not, according to our contract now, we would not have to pay increased licensing for that. Now, if we needed them to build it, you would see the requests we have here for enhancements. But there are some simple ones that we can put in there and don't have to pay increased licensing for. And so that was part of what was attractive to us about this system.
Mr. Co-Chair, what is a user? Is that someone in your office or some?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Co-Representative Nicholas, a user to us is somebody in our office. So when I talked about the interface with the public, we don't charge for that. You could already, if you wanted to see one of the things we built, our online plat book, you could look at our website and use that, and any user could use that, and we don't charge a fee for that. The other one I mentioned was online payments. There is a user fee for online payments, but we aren't charging members of the public to use that.
So how do you what's a cost per user, and is it cost efficient to have everyone in your office have a license to it or a user connection? So you have central hubs. How does it work?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we do believe that to be cost efficient, in part because of the efficiencies we gain from every user being able to look at it. The one place where we wonder about the cost efficiency there would be we put every user on it for our time tracking. Right? So if there becomes, and there's some talk in the state that there would be a time tracking feature available from the auditor's office, at that point we could reassess whether we would need to have all of our users on the system. If they're just using it for time tracking, then they're not using it for land management.
You can get a time tracking thing for $1,100 for your whole agency if you want to. I mean, how does it tie into the data on the program?
Mr. Chairman, and we do believe this will start to tie in for when we are making these, the things I wanted to say about what we're doing with our land management would be we can then track what time people have spent on a particular land unit, right? And see whether it's a problem parcel that it would be better to dispose of, or whether it's a parcel that we've spent a significant amount of time on trying to generate revenue, but we're not actually doing that.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on.
All right. Mr. Chairman, then, our next priority, or our next, I'm sorry, exception in this unit is our exception for our trust land preservation and enhancement account. And that was our fourth priority. That begins on the bottom of page 37. Now, you've heard from us from our trust land management account. You hear from us every time we're here. And that was intentional. You'll recall, I tell you every time, when this account was created in 2005, one of the requests from the legislature was that it not become a standard budget item. You requested that we return every biennium and request money for this account. So if you'll recall, this account was established to allow the Board of Land Commissioners to pursue projects that it would either enhance or preserve our assets. Those we've listed in there. I won't go through all of those because there's a fairly lengthy narrative about that in the budget book. But they're various projects. They are projects like forest, timber stand improvement, range management type of projects. We allow certain, sometimes we have to do environmental studies on our parcels. This is the account we use to take care of that. So the request you saw before you, or that you see before you, was to return this account to its historical funding. And by historical, I mean previous to the last biennium. At that time, we had requested on a regular basis, $736,500. That was the amount that was typically in our trust preservation and enhancement account. Last biennium, that was cut. The reason I sought to return it to its normal funding was, if you'll recall, one of the additional cuts that we made was to our weed and pest program. And one of the rationales for suggesting the cut to our weed and pest program was we could send some of the projects to this account. They overlapped in some ways.
Mr. Coacher, the other one was to have the leaseholders take care of it.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. To take care of the weed and pest programs. That's correct.
I'm sorry. Can you save me the research? How much was the appropriation last biennium?
That's what I'm getting to. The appropriation last biennium was $419,467. And that is the amount the governor recommends. So he did not recommend our full request here. He recommended the amount that we received last biennium.
And can you remind me of why we wanted to keep this out of the standard budget?
You know, in 2005, I wasn't here in 2005, but my recollection and my understanding from Susan was there was some nervousness, I don't know about nervousness, there's some concern that if there wasn't significant legislative oversight of this account, that things could get out of hand. We might be spending that money for things that were not originally intended. So in addition to asking us to come back and ask for it for an exception request every time, there were significant requests for reporting. And we do report all of the projects that we send through this through this account to the Joint Agriculture Committee. If any of you have sat on Joint Ag, every time we're before Joint Ag, we tell them the projects that we spend the money from this account on. And so I just think it was some thought that we don't want an agency with a large pool of money out there for projects that we think We actually want to see a benefit to the trust land. We actually want to see that land enhanced. And I think it came from that. But I'm going to just give one look to Susan and see if I've explained that correctly. It was for transparency's sake.
Wouldn't it still all be listed there if it was part of the standard budget?
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree, but we did agree to continue when it was funded in 2005. Officials from our office agreed that we would ask for it as an exception request every time, and so I continued to want to honor that agreement. If it's something you are tired of seeing as an exception request, I'm happy to work with budget folks to put it somewhere else in our budget.
If I could ask either you or Susan with the institutional memory, have other JAC committee members since 2005 asked why this was an exception request?
Susan says yes, Mr. Chairman.
They wanted to see it as an exception.
They want to see it as
they had continued to indicate to us that they wanted to see it as an exception request.
Okay.
But again, if that's something you're tired of seeing and don't want to see that way, we're happy to sort that out.
Right now we're just listening.
Okay. And that's all the exception requests in 102. Unless there's further questions, I can move on to 103.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So given that the governor didn't approve all of the funding requests that you have listed there on 39 and 40 and such like in there, what will the focuses be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we will likely reduce the focus in all of them proportionally.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, can I add to that? You know, the amounts that we give in here are estimates, and so those weren't firm numbers anyway, but we would reduce proportionally.
And the other thing you didn't, well, I don't know that you needed to mention, but this is mostly school foundation program funding.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. When this was originally conceived again in 2005, most of the money that we spend on these parcels comes from school foundation because they're school trust lands. And that's at the time that this was conceived, that was where we wanted to spend the money. It's important to note, though, then what that means is with a smaller general fund, for any lands that are not common school, we have to make sure that we're using the general fund monies on those and tracking those appropriately.
And that's where that 4% is?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So if we go with the governor's recommendation and bring it back to what it was last biennium, will that percentage stay the same?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it does. I think, let me remind myself.
I'm getting a bunch of bobbleheads in the back going.
Yes, it's right. Yes, that is correct.
Okay,
I just needed to remind myself of the number.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, and I think you said this, but I just want to get it in my head. So this account, is this where, like, lease payments go?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, it is not. It is not. We send all lease payments to the appropriate permanent account based on the land unit for which that generated that revenue. So if it was school trust land, we send that to school trust land. This money gets appropriated then out of the school foundation account.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, so I see like there's range improvement projects, timber stand improvement projects. Obviously, we charge for grazing, we charge for timber. So these are projects that are on and above what you would be able to do through your normal fee structure. So kind of explain the relationship between this and are we – so these are projects that could be paid for out of a different account as well, correct, if you had money in those accounts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, it could be if the legislature so said. So right now, according to all the statutes that we have, we are required to deposit the money into either, so I'm just going to use common school as an example, the common school income account or the common school permanent account. Now, the legislature at some point says some of that goes to the school foundation account, right? So we just deposit those where they go. We right now have no authority to not deposit those funds in the accounts that you have designated. So if we wanted to use a lease payment for some of these projects, we would need your permission for that. But if that was something you wanted to do, I think that is something that could be done.
Any other questions? I'm sorry, you're going to say something.
No, I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, if there's no further questions, I'll move on to Unit 103.
I don't think there are any. I don't see any further questions.
All right. Unit 103. And again, I start at the table. The table is on page 49. For Unit 103, this is our clean water unit. our Clean Water State Revolving Fund. Obviously, those we're administering that program. That's the program that provides funding to cities, towns, and counties and local governments for water pollution control projects. This is primarily federally funded. The standard budget for this unit is $16,966,428. That's 80% federal funds. That's 20% of other funds. We do have an exception request in here that's on line item 901, and that's for the annual audit. We have requested $16,000. The reason we request this is because we are administering, and if you want the narrative for this, let me tell you what page that's on. The narrative is on page 47. Because we're administering federal funds, we have to have a particular audit of this program every year, and it has to meet the designated federal requirements. And the cost of those audits, because they keep requiring additional things to be audited, continues to go up. We contacted our auditor. They estimate that it'll go up $8,000 each year, and so we are requesting $16,000 to be able to cover the additional costs of the audit.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director Hill, my memory has it that this was a fund that had not been used because it is a loan rather than a grant. And am I on the right track there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I actually believe you're thinking of the drinking water, which will be up later.
Very good. Thank you. I'll hold my comments then.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 46, where you've got the revenue source chart, there's the 1920 it looks like you're estimating the federal money to go up. Is that what's your thinking there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we get these numbers from the feds. They do continue to vary the amount we get, and so they have indicated they're going to put additional water into the clean water program, and that's why we believe it will go up.
Follow up? Well, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My other question is because it says it's to do water pollution control, can this be used by localities for stormwater drainage systems?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, yes. Actually, stormwater goes to drinking water. Goes to our drinking water program. There's various ones that fall under clean water, and there's various ones that fall under drinking water. But yes, between the two programs, we can cover stormwater projects.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, that got a buzzing. Mr. Co-Chair.
So on going back to page 41, I noticed that the governor's recommendation reduced the school foundation obligations, but not the general fund obligations on the amounts. being used. So I'm just curious, why wouldn't we drop general funds if we're dropping the school foundation funds an equal percentage amount?
Mr. Chairman, I think the thinking would be to leave some in the general fund so we're able to cover those trust lands that are not common school lands.
Well, we could do that with less. I mean, it's just it's a proportionate cut.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, sure you could. 26 isn't a lot to get a project done, and I think the theory would be you would need some to at least allow some sort of project if you needed one.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, I'm on page, 46 and goes over to 47 on the funding. It looks like this account continues to grow and put money in. And I imagine it won't grow indefinitely. And even though it's a loan account, is there any other use for these funds? I mean, we've got, you know, right now it looks like $111 million in there that's sitting. Can we make better use of this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, the problem related to that is it's the federal government that declares the uses you can use for the Clean Water Funds because they're vastly, or the vast majority of them is Clean Water Funds. The important thing to note, though, of the Clean Water Program is all of our first round funds goes to DEQ. And so DEQ uses those first for the leaking underground storage tank program. And so they are getting utilized at a state level. But as far as this fund growing, I think that was the intent. When you think about the original intent of both the Clean Water Program and the Drinking Water Program, it was to create a revolving fund that states could use to fund these types of programs. Now, the original concept was that the federal government would only capitalize these funds for approximately, I think the original concept was 20 years, but they continue to capitalize those way past the 20 years that was originally envisioned. And so you do see those funds continue to grow, but, and that's because the concept was that they would be revolving. Even after we loan them out, they come back into the same account with interest and then are able to be loaned out again. So I think the concept was to grow it, but one of the reasons it continues to grow is the federal government continues to capitalize those programs.
Representative Larson. Oh, I'm sorry. Follow up. Sorry.
So,
sorry, Lloyd.
Director, the leaking underground storage tank process is winding down. We're taking care of those. They're being cleaned up and that, and eventually we'll have eliminated most of that. At that point, then, what happens to these funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, something I should have mentioned before, one of the things you've seen us start to do, too, is use this for landfill remediation as well. So DEQ is using those funds, so you're right, Leaking Underground is starting to wrap up their activities. We've started to use it for landfills as well. So we are using those funds. DEQ uses those funds and then pays back from that same account.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So in Agency Fund 604, does the interest go back into the fund or is the interest used for something else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, the interest for these funds goes back into the account to be loaned out again.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So I guess one last question. Are we making good use of these funds? There's a lot of money sitting there that I can see environmental needs that I don't know we're addressing or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, and I think this goes to what Representative Larson was talking about, the drinking water program. To some extent, I don't have a great deal of control over that. What I have to do is convince local governments who are the folks that could do these type of projects that they would like to utilize this funding. And as Representative Larson indicated, some of our local governments aren't keen on the idea of taking a loan from this program because, one, it's a loan and you have to pay it back, but two, it comes with federal strings and requirements that they would have to use. So if there's other available sources of funding for our local governments, oftentimes they would choose to use that ahead of time. I do see these accounts, though, as very important in terms of if other types of local government funding goes away, these are there and they are available. And even though entities might not like a loan and might not like the federal requirements, to get these types of projects done, this is a source of funding that they could turn to. And I would note, with regard to the drinking water program, we did, you've heard all of our talks about how we weren't utilizing that fund, and we're getting some serious letters from the EPA and indications that they were going to take some action if we didn't reduce the balance of that account. We've done, I think, a pretty good job of that. We've done a lot of things to get folks, our local governments, to use those funds, and we have reduced that balance. And then, of course, we didn't take the one capitalization grant.
Representative Larson.
So, Bridget, correct me, but I believe that there's been some strategic planning on the use of this. Not only we have to maintain a certain amount in there for projected out for to control potential leaking underground storage tank remediation into the future, as well as then we start diverting, I want to say in 20 or 21, over to the remediation to fill that gap in our landfill remediation. And so I think this body and the legislature has kind of strategically planned on the use of this well into the future. Am I right there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that is correct. In fact, it was a lot of time spent with the Minerals Committee sorting out when the legislature indicated we could start using those funds as well for the landfill remediation. There was a great deal of analysis that went into that as to when, what the funding would be and when we would start changing that over.
Representative Schwartz?
I didn't raise my hand, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. So,
see, it was the pensive look on your
face. Yeah, no. Thank you. I appreciate this. Because, so, Bridget,
it was the slack-jawed look.
So the LUST program we view as a finite program, and we're taking care of that. So we'll move to landfill remediation, but ultimately that's going to be a finite program as well, if I'm not mistaken. Then what do we do with the money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, I think that's far enough in the future that I haven't come up with a good answer to that now. But I do think there will be something we will need to look at. But I don't doubt that we could work with our partners at DEQ to find a use of that money. There's many environmental, and the reason we would work with our partners at DEQ would be those are the type of projects that the feds have indicated you can use this money for. I don't doubt that we could find projects or a need for that money.
Are other states also, farther along in the process where they're closer to looking for the next use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, it really depends on the state. What you will find, we're one of the small states. So if you look at small states, all of us have kind of a similar problem in terms of we don't necessarily have enough projects to use all the money that we have. And so our fund continues to grow as far as money sitting there, not obligated to a project. But if you look at the bigger states, they wouldn't be using their money for these projects. They wouldn't be giving their first round funds to their equivalent of a DEQ. They have projects that they could use for first round funds, and so their funding is limited. And so it really depends on the state. Again, the one I think we're most closely comparative to would be South Dakota. And I think they're in the same boat as us in terms of first let's work on our environmental problems like leaking underground storage tank. But it would very much depend on how each state set up their program.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, then that brings us to Unit 104. Unit 104, again, I started the table, page 57. The Unit 104 is our government grant and loan unit. These are the folks that are taking care, that are administering the statutory grant and loan programs that the legislature has provided, our MRG, our aeronautics, our farm loans, our TEA. The funding that we have for this unit for the standard budget is $523,669. We have no exception requests, and the governor does recommend this budget as presented.
Questions? Seeing none, let's move on.
All right. The next unit then is Unit 105. The table for that unit is on page 66. This unit, as the name would indicate, are the folks out there doing our inspections and taking care of our field-related activities. We also have our appraisals running through our field services division. This unit has a standard budget of $2,362,884. We have no exception requests for this unit, and the governor does recommend this budget as presented.
No questions. Please move on.
Excellent. The next unit is Unit 131. This is our drinking water state revolving.
There'll be questions.
There may be questions. This is our drinking water state revolving fund unit. This unit has a standard budget of $11,151,201. Again, the vast majority of that being federal funds. They're running our drinking water state revolving fund program. We do have one exception request in this unit. It would be 5B. The narrative for that begins on page 70. And this is the same as what we had in our clean water. Again, it's a request for increased audit fees. You see the same amount, the $16,000. We're under the same requirement for audit in this unit.
Who actually does these audits?
Mr. Chairman, we have a contractor. Currently, our contractor is McGee, Hearn, and Pice.
And so they're the ones that came back and said, it's going to cost you this much more?
Mr. Chairman, we reached out to them and asked what they thought the fees would be, and yes, the estimate comes from them.
And how often do you compare fees with a like business?
You know, Mr. Chairman, this one we got through an RFP, and you make a good point. It may be time to float that again for another RFP to see if we could do better. Part of the reason we use McGee, Hearn, and Pice is they have a lot of institutional knowledge, and so when they come to audit us, they know what we're about, and it's a little bit easier on us. But you make a very good point that definitely it makes some sense to maybe send it out to another RFP. I think it's been
5 years.
It's been 5 years.
Representative Larson.
Thank you. And Director Hill, you've partially answered this. It sounds like we're using this fund a little more. And, you know, if you could, and I'm sure that you've prepared that somewhat, if we could get that report of who's using it and how those funds are, it's just interesting to me. I'd like to look at that. And this does include stormwater as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, yes. Yes. And we do. We, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the drinking water fund. And I think even when we were before you in the end of October, we had generated some reports related to that. And I'd be happy to make sure they have the information you have and get those to you.
Thank you.
No other questions. Let's move on.
Mr. Chairman, if it's...
Representative Larson.
Thank you. Just what interest rate is that back to the municipalities that use... get those loans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, it's 2.5% loan. You know, there is the one thing that I think is great about these programs, too. There's a certain amount of principal forgiveness available. The feds require us to allow principal forgiveness. So for some of our entities, they don't have to repay all of it. They get principal forgiveness in many terms, similar to a grant in that instance. The other thing we have is if they qualify for green project status, they get a 0% loan. Again, that's something the feds have asked us to provide for.
But they still have to pay back the principal.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So how do you get in on this principal forgiveness business?
Mr. Chairman, the federal government indicated to us criteria we had to consider. Typically, to get better principal forgiveness, you would need to be a smaller community. But there's a whole list. It's in our rules. We had to promulgate rules for this of the things we have to consider. And it's basically, we keep calling it affordability criteria. So you would take into account their population. So whether they can charge fees to additional people. So their population, their median household income.
Oh, so they'd apply, then you study it and tell them, yeah, you can, or otherwise just, you know.
Mr. Chairman, we're able to do that analysis now. We wouldn't necessarily need them to apply. We don't typically look at it until somebody applies. But we could do that without them. And sometimes they'll come to our office and say, would we be eligible for principal forgiveness? And we can figure that out for them before they apply.
Wouldn't this be the same kind of analysis you would do while they're first applying for the loan in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, we do. Sometimes they come to us before. Sometimes they don't want to go through the hassle of actually applying. And so they might come to our office and say, am I eligible for principal forgiveness and in what amount? And we would tell them. And
before
then
they actually borrow the money?
Yes.
How much do you often
forgive? Mr. Chairman.
And how much do you forgive before you loan it?
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Nicholas, first of all, I'll answer, because I think your question came first in time, about how much it was. I think it ranges. It also depends on how they fall in the affordability criteria. So some folks are eligible for 50%. Some folks are eligible even for 75% principal forgiveness. Those are less. It's typically 50. Some people are not eligible at all. We do have some communities that would never be eligible, for principal forgiveness because of the affordability criteria. Your question was, how do we tell them how much we could forgive, if they don't have a loan yet? Fair point. We give them an estimate of how much they would be eligible for if they applied for that amount. So it is based on a projection.
All right. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so to that, the principle of forgiveness seems to fly contrary to establishing this revolving loan. So then if you forgive so much principal, then does the Feds they are continuing to fund anyway, but in the event that they stop funding, would they make up the difference of that principal that you forgive that diminishes the total overall account?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, they would not. And I think their theory is that they are already overfunding past what they had promised to fund these revolving fund loan programs for. Now, it's important to note, though, I think the point you're getting to is once they stop funding us and we have our own revolving account that is no longer capitalized by them, we wouldn't be offering principal forgiveness.
When you've got cities coming to you for this thing, is it often tied in with annexations, things like that?
You know, Mr. Chairman, it really depends on the projects that they have. Some of them are for that. Some of them are simply replacements. They have a whole big project where they would need to replace water lines. So it's for existing water systems that they have there. And so we see a whole variety. Sometimes they come and they need water meters. There's these tiny communities that have never had water meters, and they're not measuring the water that they're giving to each citizen. And so they're not able to charge them appropriately. So it's a wide range. Some of it is very much for development, but some of it's simply taking care of the system as it exists now.
Thank you. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize if I missed this. Up in our neck of the woods, we've had a lot of issues in relation to the Platte River and the selenium and all the work that's being done by the conservation crew and many, many other organizations, but it potentially could affect that water system there and that water treatment plant. What is there a cap on what this program can do for a community size-wise? Like, can you borrow as much as you feel like you can borrow, or are there caps?
Mr. Chairman, there's not a cap on the size of loan that they could get from us. Typically, the limiting factor for them is the amount they would have to pay back. So we would have to have some source of repayment that could show us they would be able to pay that back over time. And so that's typically been the limiting factor for the communities that come before us. But there's no cap on the loan amount. The one program we have that has a cap would be farm loan, but all of our other loan programs don't have a cap on the amount they could request.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up comment. We're hopeful that the river is in better shape and will stay that way. But that potential impact, that might be why you haven't heard from that part of the world, but hopefully you would if they needed it. And we're talking about multi-millions of dollars if we have to put in a different water treatment.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, we do try to be somewhat proactive about that because the process for clean water and drinking water is all of those projects have to be on an intended use plan. So we do try to be proactive about reaching out to folks and seeing what possible projects they might have. It has to be on an intended use plan approved before they could get funding. Mr. Chairman, so if it is pleasing to you, I would turn it over to the state forester, Bill Crapser, because we've reached the point in our budget where he would take over, except there are two minor items at the end that then I will address, or two additional units.
Sounds good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the forestry budget, the forestry division budget, is basically divided into five different units. One thing I want to point out before we get started is we did split several years ago. We did split our FTEs up between our 201 budget, our operations budget, and our 401 budget, our fire budget. That's a little bit of a misnomer because being foresters, we are jack of all trades, and everybody in the organization has fire responsibilities. That's not what you see on the fire budget isn't who's involved in fire. Everybody's involved in fire. Mr. Chairman, I'd first refer you to pages 82 and 83. Those are the chart for the our standard, our operations budget, our 201 budget. In this budget, we have 42 personnel in this budget. This is where we do all of our day-to-day operations. It's also where our inmate conservation program is funded out of the operations budget. We had no exception requests on that budget.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you asked a question. I'm sorry?
Oh, the three. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, that
page
unit,
81.
That unit did have the 320 reduction for the entire agency in it. We are got to a point where when we looked agency-wide at priority list and tried to look at things that were statutorily or constitutionally mandated, things that made money for the trust, that's how the agency developed our priorities. The only program we have that is not statutorily required is our inmate conservation program. The 320 budget reduction would impact that to the tune of two personnel. The problem, I guess I would say, as far as saying that it's not statutory or mandated, is that program supports everything else we do. It supports our trust land management program. It deeply supports our fire program. It supports our fire supports Homeland Security. I would refer you to page 81 and the governor's denial of our 320 recommendation is that it would deeply impact our ability to respond to wildfires, respond to floods, respond to other crises around the state.
Representative Summers.
So, Mr. Chairman, after examining your budget again, is this still the best place to make? Perhaps we don't do that maintenance agreement for $359,000, and you take your 320 cut there. That's not going to. Is that going to impact the ability to cover fires in the state of Wyoming?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, it would not impact our ability to cover fires, but it would impact our ability to generate revenue from our state trust land, which is our mission. And so when we looked at this, again, we looked at the priority list, which is available in our budget book of our programs. And at the bottom is our conservation crews. And so for us, given the fact that we look to constitutional duties first, statutory duties second, and then anything that's not either of those things last, it did make sense to us.
Representative Summers.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate this, but oftentimes, you know, it would appear that these 320s can sometimes be directed to where it looks like the world's going to end. And Mr. Chairman, your admin has not taken a position cut, as you told me, in the whole time of this budget cut. And so we're going to cut boots on the ground in our first attempt to make a 320 here. We're going to cut boots on the ground and not anywhere else. And I just don't it's hard for me to swallow this as the only place or the best place to take a cut in your whole agency.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, and I understand what you're saying. I would note, though, our priority list has always been the priority list that it's been. So what when you say maybe we pick the one that would look like it would hurt the most, I don't believe we did that. We looked at our priority list as it has been for several years and said, look, the reason we made that priority list was in taking the thought of what our agency needed, what the mission of our agency was, and we made that priority list according to that. So when it came time to make 320 budget reductions, it made sense to us to look at that priority list. Now, I would be the first to admit that I didn't want to recommend that we cut this area either. But we were told to make a recommendation for a 320 reduction, and that's where we believed, in keeping with our mission, in keeping with our longstanding priority list, that that made sense to recommend the cut there. But certainly I understand what you're saying.
Representative Burkhardt.
Mr. Chairman, Bill, kind of just a side note. We had put a person in with the BLM in Rawlins a while back for forestry management. Is that program still in effect, and how's it working?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhardt, referring back to page 83 again, the one AWAC position that is listed there is that position. Forest Service is still funding part of that position. BLM is real supportive. It's been one of those programs that, in my opinion, with a very, very small investment on the part of the state, has shown great benefits and great rewards. We've had a lot of projects done. As most of you know, we do now have good neighbor authority where we can do work on Forest Service land and on BLM land, and that position is really helping us move those projects forward.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. So we're still making money off of that position. I think we were making more than paying for the individual by what we were getting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhardt, yeah, as far as the economic stimulus to Carbon County, to the area, it's money well spent.
Thank you.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know much about the Honor Conservation Program, so maybe I should know this, but when you put a team together to respond to one of these projects, are those inmates paid? Is that part of this budget? Is it we pay people to help us out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Landon, yes, the inmates are paid. I don't have the rate on the top of my head. They're paid by Department of Corrections on a monthly basis for the project work they do, the community service work. If we do have them on a fire, there is a rate, and it's dependent on how long they've been in the program, how much fire experience they have. And I think it maxes out, I think, at $5 an hour for if they're on a fire, but only on the fire. But most of them are in the dollar, dollar and a half range that they get extra. So there is an incentive for the inmates to not only be involved, but to be fairly dedicated to it and to help learn a new skill while they're incarcerated.
So, Mr. Chairman, obviously they're being paid by the Department of Corrections, and then over and above that, if they do, as you just described, they can make a little bit of extra money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, yeah, the fire pay comes through our budget.
Right.
However, if they're on a forest, when we get in the fire budget, you'll see there's some federal reimbursement funds in there. That allows us to charge the federal government if we're on a federal fire, that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you help me understand what else the Honor Conservation Corps does? As I read this summary, it talks about the impacts on floods and fires and other things, but are there other things that the Honor Conservation, was it created to do other things in other than this, and what percentage of the time is actually spent on these emergency situations versus the other things that they might do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, the way we have the conservation program set up, the inmates in the program and our crew supervisors work on state trust land. We do forestry projects. We do fencing projects, different types of projects on state trust land. Also do an awful lot of community service work, mainly in the northeastern part of the state, but they have been over to Buffalo. They have actually been over in the Bighorn Basin on some projects, doing work for local communities when they're not on an emergency assignment. Also do the tree protectors that you, as you drive around the state, you see the little net protectors that are on, like, living snow fences that are protecting the trees. Our inmate program makes that. They do about according to the note I just was passed, about 30% of their time is spent on fire and emergency response. About 50% of their time is spent on trust land management, working to support the rest of the goals of the Office of State Lands, and about 20% of their time are community service type projects.
And so on these, and I want to be careful not to be taken wrong, but the community service stuff, is that kind of field work if they don't have something else to do? And if it is not, is there a reimbursement back to state lands if they're doing something for a municipality, or do they get reimbursed back on anything from YDOT if they're doing stuff on the living snow fences along our highways?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, One of the big projects we do is we do a lot of work for State Fair. And State Fair, Department of Ag, State Fair reimburses us for any overtime our folks incur, correctional officer overtime, that sort of thing. Most communities, if they're in the local area where it's a day trip, like if they're going to do a project for Upton, historically we have not charged municipalities for that work. And it's a day type trip. If they're doing work farther away, like if they are over in the Bighorn Basin doing a type of project, we negotiate with the municipality to cover any overtime that's expended and food and lodging for the inmate crews. Because when we do have the crews out overnight, it has a whole nother security issue. We have to have correctional officers with them. We have to have a secure place to bed them and to feed them.
Let's continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, next I would refer you to page 88. That is the unit 5001. It's called the Fire Protection Revolving Account. That account, as you will see in the budget, we have the request is for $2 million spending authority. There is about $400,000 balance in that account is all. How we run that account is it's the work. All of you have seen the deuce and a halfs, the 5-ton fire trucks around the state. We manufacture those trucks. We get the chassis from the federal government. We remanufacture those trucks in our shop here in Cheyenne. At that point, they are loaned out to the counties, but the cost of that remanufacture is charged to the counties. So what this account does, it allows us to build those trucks. Let's say Crook County orders a truck from us. We will build the truck for Crook County. Then we'll charge Crook County for what it cost us to build the truck. That money goes back into this account. So it's a revolving account to allow us to build and maintain those fire engines that are around the state. Currently, we have in excess of 300 of those type of fire trucks around the state. It's about 45% of the wildland fire capability in the state of Wyoming are trucks that are run through this program.
And so this is special revenue, and that special revenue is the money that is paid back by these counties?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And how much is in that account right now?
Mr. Chairman, on page 86, it shows the account balance. The estimate right now is about $425,000.
So the $2 million is basically just spending authority to.
That's correct,
turn it
Mr.
Over.
Chairman.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, looking at the bottom of page 85, where it says, in the revenue narrative, expenditures and revenue for this period are lower due to availability of parts at no cost through the FFP program. So then I look at the top of the next page, actual for the fiscal year, $205,000, and then going up to $2 million, and I realize that's just kind of a plug number. But am I understanding correctly then that that right now we have parts at no cost through this program, and so you're spending less, and so thus you have to bill the municipalities and counties less, but when you don't have these parts available anymore, like in the subsequent biennia, you will have to pay more for them and bill more for them? Is that, I mean, so it's in a couple of years, is the cost to the county and local fire services going to go up, I assume?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we hope not. We strive to keep this as low a cost a program and as efficient a program to the counties as possible. We have, with the military operations that the country's had for the last several years, we have had shortages of parts and had to go out on commercial market to buy some parts. We are seeing right now a little bit of an uptick and increase in some parts we can get. We're pretty optimistic we're going to be able to keep this very low cost to the counties. Another reason that we see some years where we have lower expenditures or lower billings on this account is, as I said earlier, everyone in our organization has fire responsibility. If we have a really busy fire season, two or three of our mechanics end up being out on fires all season, and they aren't building trucks for the counties at that time. So that's one reason that varies.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I could go back to the honor conservation thing, I'm just trying to get my head around this a little more. Can you tell me how many inmates are involved in that, and if it's the same ones through the, I understand their incarceration may change, but is it the same ones through the course of that, and are you providing training for them so that when they go into fire, that it's those guys that go, or is it just who's available and who's willing to go? Educate me a little bit, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, the state several years ago, as a state forestry entity and as the Rural Firemen, the Firemen's Association in the state, endorsed what's called the National Wildfire Coordinating Group 310-1, which is qualification guidelines. So we endorse that we aren't going to send anybody on fires except for some volunteer on initial attack type thing on long-duration fires, and we're not going to send any state people on fires unless they're qualified to be on fire. So the inmates that come into our program, they have to apply for the forestry program. They're screened by our folks. Then the ones that are going to be able to go out on fire have to go through basic fire training and be qualified to go out on fire. Everything from some basic fire behavior to utilizing fire shelters, all the safety type of thing. And then they're available on fire. The same with our crew supervisors. We have right now 9 people in that program. The guys that take the crews out on fire are qualified to be squad bosses to take folks out on fire. So they are qualified. As far as the inmates, with corrections numbering system, one challenge we have had with our inmates for fire is the length of time we can keep an inmate in the program. Obviously, the longer we can keep them in the program, the more fires they're on, the more experienced they are, the better and safer fire crew we have. So we really strive to have our folks that we send out on fire, that we're doing it with the utmost safety and making sure that we're following all the rules.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman, please. So how many people are in that program for flood and fires, just total? How many are in that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, with fire rules and with corrections rules, it's a 7-1 span of control. So we have 7 crew supervisors, and 2 of our folks are in more leadership positions, so 49 inmates is what would be a full program for us. We could use our leadership and squeak another 14 out if we had the trained inmates available.
So, Mr. Chairman, so these 2 positions that you had recommended in your 320 does not mean a total loss of the honor program. That just means 2 of those individuals, which would be a decrease of 14 inmates that would be available for use.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that's correct. Unless you factor in vacations and sick leave, and then it kind of, if you have people, let's say we have 7 crew supervisors, we probably, normally we say we can field 35 or 5 squads of smoke busters because somebody's usually sick or on days off or that sort of thing. So it would have a bigger impact than just the 14, but numerically, yes, you're correct.
Representative Wilson, that had her hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of follow up on that, though, out of curiosity, so talking about as far as if the training enhances the inmates' capabilities, I mean, it's good for them while they're there, but doesn't having a felony conviction preclude someone from being a firefighter out in the rest of the world?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we have had people that have been in our program that have gone on to work in wildland fire. Several places around the country, Utah has several contract crews. They're not government employees. They're contract crews. I know several of our inmates have gone on to that. Because of the state lands work and every other thing, I know a lot of the inmates have been able to maybe not be wildland firefighter, but get jobs with loggers or with thinning crews, that sort of thing, after they get out of the program.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So I'm kind of really hung up on this 320 thing. So I'm contemplating a – so what if we did a pro rata reduction of all of your general fund exception requests until we got to what your 320 was? So that's a 100 – you give me the number. It was less than the 238 because you had to cut positions to get – so explain to me, would that still be worse – for the agency than cutting these two positions? And if so, why would that be worse?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, again, I think it depends on what you see the and what I understand the mission of the Office of State Lands and Investments as a whole to be. We have a constitutional mission to take care of the state trust lands and all the lands that were granted to the state. And so I think that mission has to come first. And so when we look at that, and that's how we prioritized it, that mission would be to generate revenue from these trust lands. And so when you start cutting other areas, it impedes our ability to reach that mission. It impedes our ability to generate revenue, which we need right now in this state. And so, yes, it does harm us in that sense. Now, I think the point you're getting to, though, the state as a whole, right? Because when we're talking about fires and we're talking about floods, we're looking at things that aren't necessarily our mission as the Office of State Lands and Investments. We're looking at things that are important to the state as a whole. And I don't disagree that those things are important to the state as a whole. But when I had to make my priority list and I had to, in consultation with Bill, determine what cut we would recommend, we had to look at our mission first. And so that's what we did. And I do believe if you start making those pro rata cuts in other areas of our office, it hurts in terms of us being able to fulfill our mission.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you have that maintenance agreement for X number of dollars, which if that were clipped a little bit, would that just clip the number of positions that you could? So instead of right now you're funded, you told me it's 16. Mm-hmm. This allows you to put all 98 on. So if that amount was clipped a little, would that mean you could only put 80 on, for example? Or are you like, it's all or nothing, or in fact you just have a few computers that don't end up on the system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, it would decrease the amount that we could have on the system. What that would mean, though, if we don't have all of them on the system, is we would have to revert to our old time tracking ways, because we needed all of them on the system to be able to time track all together. And so you would essentially say we're not going to use time tracking through that system if we can't have all of them on that license. But certainly the other parts, the land part and whatnot, it would just be reduced amount of users.
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, so that's currently what you're doing. You don't have these dollars now, so this is the future, these 98. This isn't current, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, we were able to put them all on with leftover money from before. So they're all on there now, the 98 are. But that money is going to run out.
interesting.
All right, let's see if we can pick up a case.
Mr. Chairman, I would refer you now to page 89, our next budget unit, our emergency fire suppression account. This is the account that we have for assisting counties, assisting fire departments, and utilizing ourselves on state trust land for large fires, for large fire suppression. The standard budget is approximately $2.6 million. That's spending authority. That's not money appropriated. Whenever the legislature has appropriated money to it, it's been come through an exception request or floor action. If you move to page...
Where's the revenue come from?
Page 91, sir, I will explain
you.
That. If you look at page 91 with the balances, the revenue comes from two places. The counties that participate in the suppression count, and right now we have 21 counties participating in the suppression account, pay dues every year based on the valuation of the county. Then the legislature has put money in over the years. In fact, almost 85% of the money that's ever been in the account has been appropriated by the legislature. The county dues are run dependent on where the valuations are on a given year, run anywhere from about $250,000 to about $500,000 a year is the county dues. The last time the legislature put a big chunk of money in, if you'll recall, 2012, we had a barnstorm of a fire season. As a state, we spent over $40 million. And that next session, you all put an additional $20 million in the suppression account to beef up the numbers a little bit. In today's fire cost, if you look at the fires that they had in California here last month, they spent, between the Forest Service and the state, they spent almost $300 million in the month of December in California. So fire costs escalate fairly quickly. Right now, as of today, there's about $18 million in the account. We still have some outstanding fire bills from both the 2017 fire season and the 2016 fire season. So we're estimating by the time all of those bills are paid, we'll have a balance in the account, some probably around $14 million moving forward in the account. Because of that, Mr. Chairman, we aren't asking for an exception request or an appropriation for the account at this time and just have the standard budget.
I know we ask you every year, who are the two counties that don't participate?
Campbell and Sweetwater, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I assume we still fight the fire. What would their contribution be if they did?
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Nicholas, I just off the top of my head, I'm saying I think Campbell County's assessment last year that because we send it out to them anyhow, and then they declined to pay or to participate, about $115,000 a year. Theirs would be the highest. They've done the math, and they feel that they're better off using those monies internally for fighting fire in the state.
But if
in the county, I'm sorry.
But if a fire breaks out in either of those counties, you still.
Mr. Chairman, we still respond to it. We still support them. However, private land, it's Campbell County's or Sweetwater County's responsibility. We don't help them financially pay for the fire. All the other counties, the account kicks in and we pay for the fire.
Representative Larson.
I was just curious that we still had 2016 bills not paid, and I'm wondering why that is and who that obligation is to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, particularly because of the size of the fire seasons they've had for the last several years, the U.S. Forest Service has got way behind in their billing cycles. They've got way behind their paperwork. And it also is exacerbated. If you'll recall, in 2012, we had resources from 37 different states in Wyoming helping us with the fires. They bill the Forest Service, who bills us, and our neighbor to the south is notoriously slow on their billings. In fact, we have sent bills back to them and said, hey, this is from two bienniums ago. We're not going to pay this. So, we pride ourselves, I think we're pretty efficient in billing other states or other, federal agencies when we need to, but a lot of our, colleagues are pretty slow in their billings.
Let's move on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd refer you to page 97. This is our overall fire budget. I told you we had divided our operations in our fire into two different budgets just to try to keep some things straight. On this, it shows on the headcount that we have 5 permanent FTEs and 4 seasonals. A question I've received is, what do our fire people do when they're not fighting fire, the 5 that are on this list? These include our rural fire trainer, who does training all around the state for rural fire departments, all during the year. It also includes our fire business staff, who does our fire billings, make sure all of that is up to date, and issues the red cards, the qualification cards. So we're charging them to the fire budget, but they are, actually, they're people that are doing day-to-day stuff all year round to support the fire program. The 4 part-time count is our 4 seasonal employees that we have that staff our state heli-attack, which is our initial attack helicopter operation we have out of Glen Rock. That program, this last year was the 15th year that we've had that program. We have it designed as initial attack. On a normal basis, if they get a fire call in any county, whether it's an EFSA county or not, for assistance, our helicopter on average, unless there's some kind of weather conditions, are able to launch in about 15 minutes with the helicopter and 3 firefighters on board. This year they were on 49 fires, so even though we didn't have a huge fire season this year, that program, they responded to more fires than they have in any year. We're pretty proud of the speed that they can get there and the work they can do on the initial attack, keeping the fires small. When we start looking at fire cost, I'm a firm believer in if we can get them out in the first 2-3 hours when they're small, it's going to cost us a lot less money in the long run than letting them get big. So that's included in that program. You also see there's quite a bit of federal funds, almost, in fact, actually over half that budget shows as federal funds. That is strictly for fire reimbursements. That's for if we send folks out of state or we have a FEMA fire here where we're going to get reimbursed from the federal government, or we respond to a federal fire and they're going to reimburse us for it. That's where that's what those federal funds in that budget, and that's an estimate of what we think we'd probably do for them in a biennial period.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
A couple on that. One, these federal funds, do they go back in the discretion account as they are returned, or where do they go to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, 2 different places. If it's a FEMA fire, the federal funds, we move them back into the suppression account. All other reimbursements go back to the general fund. They don't go back into our budget.
And how much of those go back to the general fund generally on a normal type year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, I would estimate probably in a general sort of year, maybe $300,000.
About like your 320 funds. So we're actually taking fire funds and putting them back in the general account, the way it works.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Perfect. Thank you. On your 900 series, $637,000, is that your hill attack or what? I see
it. Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, yes, that's the base contract on the hill attack. We have a contract helicopter for 105 days of summer. The scary part is I got to try to guess which 105 days we're going to have the most fires in to put it under contract. That allows us to have the rapid response that we have. We have the helicopter sitting there, pilot ready to go and to launch. There is also some flight hours in that contract, but we also use The 255, which is fire payments, and the suppression account to pay for rotor time for flying the helicopter.
Chairman, comment more than follow up. I really appreciate your Hill Attack program. When I started, I was pretty critical of it. And as you know, you guys diverted this year and came up to our country and probably stopped a fire at 100 acres that was going to be a minimum of a 5,000-acre fire. Would have been a fairly major event in our county. And they happened to be in Gillette and were there in less than an hour. It was pretty interesting. Our guys had given up. It had really 100 acres had blown up and it was gone. And the Hill Attack stopped it cold. It's pretty impressive.
Thank you, sir.
They take donations. Any other questions?
So, Mr. Chairman, the final unit in the state forestry budget is on page 105. It's our federal forestry grants. We get a significant amount of money from the Forest Service every year for a variety of things. It's helped support community forestry, which is our program that we do with Tree City USAs, with helping small communities and cities improve the health of their trees, street trees, and their park trees. We also get federal funds that help with private landowner assistance, so we can write management plans for private landowners. We get some funds to use for fuels projects to help private landowners and communities do firewise, fuel breaks, defensible space. We also have what's called state fire assistance is included in here that allows us to give some sub-grants to volunteer fire departments for safety equipment. It also allows us to do a lot of the fire training we do with contractors to really leverage what we can do around the state. We've had the standard budget of $6.1 million in there. The last few years, we haven't garnered that much from the Forest Service in grants, but it's kind of a whole lot of them are competitive, and some years we do really well, and some years we don't do so well. So that's where that standard budget is, and we don't have any exception request in that unit.
Questions? Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, could you back up to page 104, 103, 104, please? You indicate that one of your revenue sources is co-lease bonus money to the point of $11.25 million. I thought we had run out of co-lease bonuses.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhardt, because I was just hitting the forestry, that's actually something I'll turn over to the director to talk about. Okay. It's one of our programs.
Director, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhardt, this is one of the last two I was going to come back and talk about. This is our mineral royalty grant unit. This is where we provide grants to cities, towns, and counties for capital construction projects around the state. we do request our standard budget, the $33,400,000. You are correct. We indicate there's coal lease bonus in there. What happens if we don't get that money? This was based on a projection that possibly we would get, and historically we have received coal lease bonus. If that money is not in the account, we obviously do not give grants for this amount. And so what typically happens is if we have less than the $33,400,000 that you have historically appropriated for this program, we simply we keep a close eye on that account, and we simply have less money to hand out to the cities, towns, and counties.
Thank you.
With that, that was 902. We have our standard budget. The governor does recommend it, and you know what that program is. The final thing to wrap it up here then would be our budget request for our unit 6801. That's our Transportation Enterprise Account Fund. We've requested our standard budget of
on page.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was doing so good for a minute there, but I let Bill talk and I forgot. Page 114 okay. is where the table is. This, like I said, our standard budget is $2 million. This program is used to hand out grants, again, to local entities that provide transportation that benefits the general public in the state. Typically, the source of revenue for this is the interest off the transportation account. That typically has not been $2 million in most recent history, and we do the same thing we would do with the mineral royalty grant. In the event there's not $2 million in there, we obviously don't hand out grants over $2 million.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, I could see back on the funds, you know, for fire suppression that you probably want them to be pretty liquid, but I'm wondering with this fund, is there any thought of putting these funds into the Amendment A pool?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, I'm so glad you asked that because, in fact, the State Loan and Investment Board at our last TEA meeting had a very discussion about this, and they were going to send a letter to the legislature saying, does it make sense to move these, because right now they're just in the state agency pool and not generating a lot of interest, requesting that those be one of the accounts moved to generate better revenue. So thank you.
Can you give me an example? What was your last sizable grant? Went where, to who, for what?
Let me think for a second. Mr. Chairman, it would be for, sometimes we have bus requests. So the biggest ones we usually get are for buses, to bus people around communities, and those come from Jackson. But a lot of what we also get would be passenger vans, handicap accessible passenger vans, to move folks in communities. So we often get a request from Riverton that makes the request? I'm forgetting the community. I apologize for that. But Lander and Riverton would request, I think, a handicap accessible bus where they can move folks to, like, senior citizen centers or
That's what I was thinking. You take requests from, for instance, senior centers, things like that.
Mr. Chairman, that is entirely correct. Some are also for entities like STRIDE that take maybe developmentally delayed children to various activities. So we get requests from them as well.
But you do subsidize the bus service up in Jackson?
If they make a request because they fit within the terms of the grant, we do.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Schwartz. From Jackson.
Thank you. And first of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for those. I don't know exactly what the grants are, but I remember that they exist. But just a comment. This year, we broke the 2017, we broke the million passenger mark for our bus system. So these grants have helped us get an incredible outcome.
Well, I'm glad our tax dollars could bus your tourists around.
Well, they're not, and I might add, they're not just our tourists. They're also our workforce coming from, among other things, Senator Dockstader's district.
I can add. There
he is. Most of those using the bus that I see are those working in the service industry. And I watch the buses as I go back and forth in Jackson.
You have a very lonely life, don't you?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson.
So is there a charge? The grant is there, but is there a charge for these people that use the bus?
Mr. Chairman, may I? It depends on the internal City of Jackson bus service is free. The commuter buses are a charge. The buses to Teton Village are a charge.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That part of what I was going to ask, but also when you talk about senior centers, it says offering, for public use. Is that, for example, like Sweetwater County has a STAR system. I don't know, Rock Springs, Green River. I don't know if those are or would be eligible. Places like we have, the CDCs, for example, would need to transport kids. Now, those are the ones that are specific to individual groups, then wouldn't be eligible for this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hassert, it depends. There is a whole list of statutory criteria. Generally, if I were to put, and we've adopted rules to say what those criteria are. But generally, the catch-all is they have to be offering transportation to members of the public. And those can be a finite set of folks, like a senior citizen center, right? But they're members of the public. And then they otherwise have to either show us that they're offering these rides to members of the public or have a contract with a public entity.
And can they then also charge the fee? I think I wasn't clear on from what the they set up in Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hazard, they may, but not all do. So, for instance, when a senior citizen center, let's say they wanted to add a 10-passenger van to their fleet and they come to us, they're not charging folks for that. But I will note they're not getting 100% grant from us either. They're getting possibly a 50% grant from us.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else on transportation? All right.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that concludes our presentation with one minor additional footnote to again say I have the utmost respect for Mr. Richards. I did not mean to call him crazy.
We all do. Senator Landon, did you have something to say?
Well, Mr. Chairman, not to belabor, I'm just hopeful that all of these entities we talked about this morning are aware of these grant programs, and I'm sure you do the best you can on that front, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, we very much do our very best. We try to participate. So a lot of the folks getting grant funding from us are local governments. So we definitely are interacting with the County Commissioners Association and WAM. The only folks that aren't typically a local government would be these transportation folks, and we've reached out to a lot of them as well. And I can't remember the name of their association, but we do interface with their association as well to let them know those grants are available.
Representative Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to that transportation account, it says you only spend 90% of the income earned on that. Does the other 10% go right back into the fund automatically, or where does that other 10% go?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, it does stay in the trust fund. Sorry, I could not remember, but that's provided by statute by you all.
Any other questions? I've got one. You gave us a handout, the trust land management objectives.
Mr. Chairman, I think that must have been from something else. But, yes, those are our trust land management objectives.
Right, and on the second page, you've got inventory of state trust lands, fiscal year 2017.
Okay.
And then you've got the list, Act of Congress prior to active admission, then after active admission. And you've got things, Capitol buildings at the Capitol, penitentiary, insane asylum, miners' hospital. And these are, and then you have the amount of land, the acreage entitlement attached to each of those.
Yes.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. I did not have this.
Are these specific pieces of property that are specifically assigned to these institutions?
Mr. Chairman,
or is it all just a portion of the big globular thing?
Mr. Chairman, let me answer it this way. So when we receive those as a land grant from the federal government, those lands were specifically, so let's say there's a parcel of common school land. We identify it as a parcel of common school land, and any revenue we generate from that particular parcel, we know goes to the common school account. The same would be true of all the other beneficiaries we list here. So university land and whatnot. That land, I just want to make sure I'm understanding your question. That land then is not necessarily where the university sits. Or
no,
it's not.
No. It benefits from it, but my question is there a 160 chunk up in Cody that is specifically benefits the agricultural college?
There may be, yes. Those are all over the state.
So these chunks of land are specifically labeled.
Yes.
And then what happens to some of these that don't exist anymore, like the poor farm?
Those got, we still track that money. That money then goes, the poor farm goes to Department of Health. Is it on there? No, it's not on there. It's Department of Health. It's Department of Health. So we've tracked them to the agency that basically took over for what that beneficiary would be.
And then those later acquisitions down at the bottom, Mariah Ranch, Sauter Green. Do those just go into the general land trust?
Mr. Chairman, they do not, because those lands were acquired either with common school funds. If you'll recall, the legislature provided us with some certain seed money from the common school account, and if we used common school funds or
then
money,
it goes to the common school
then it
account.
Goes to the common school. Or if we acquired something through exchange and we exchanged common school lands for an additional full ranch, it again would maintain that designation of common school. And that would be true for all of the beneficiaries here.
Okay, two last questions. Fish hatchery, you've got 5,600 acres of land. Do the fish hatcheries sit on that, or they just benefit from it?
Mr. Chairman, they do not. They just benefit from it.
And the other one question I had is, what about the land, what about the Carry Act? Down about three-quarters of the way down, subsequent acts, 1957. Mm-hmm. You've got the Carry Act, 24,000 acres.
And your question is, who benefits from Carry Act
yes.
land?
What is what was the general, Carry Act? In
general fund, right?
Mr. Chairman, that about once a year, you folks sweep that account. It goes to the general fund.
General fund.
It goes to the general fund. Okay.
So Carry Act lands would have been the lands that the federal government had that they wanted you to put water projects on, right? They were trying to foster less deserty type land and more productive land in terms of agriculture. And so they did end up, that program didn't fully work, and so they end up just quit claiming that to the state of Wyoming, and it goes to the general fund.
All right, thank you. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that same handout, it would be helpful, or I might suggest, it's interesting to see who those lands were originally designated to support, but it would be nice if you could put to the side what that institution is currently called or referred to, or what department benefits that, so that we, for the insane asylum, we would maybe show the state hospital or
something. Sure. Mr. Chairman, we do have that handout. It just comes in a different report, but I'd be happy to get it to you. And so I agree some of these names are not super politically correct. We've just left the designation that they originally came as.
And Mr. Chairman, and I like that, but not all of us are familiar what the current name might be. It's nice to see it in both ways. Thanks.
Absolutely. We have that.
Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you. And I'd like to especially thank Susan Child for her presence over the last 20-plus years. She's the only one who looks exactly the same as when I first got here. And Susan, it's been great, and I hope you change your mind and stay on another 20.
She makes me sound like a tyrant, but I just want to note she's had a lovely time with me as director.
Thank you very much. We will, yeah. We'll take a break and reconvene at 10 after 10. Coming back to order, the next agency up before us is the Office of the Public Defender, Ms. Lorenzo.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So, good morning. My name is Diane Lozano. I'm the Director of the Office of the State Public Defender.
My mistake.
That's okay. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Nicholas, members of the House and Senate, I guess I'll first introduce the people who are with me today. To my right is Becky Meza. She's the Fiscal Officer. Directly behind me to my right is Ryan Roden. He's the deputy of the State Public Defender's Office. To his right is Dan Wild. He is the deputy of the Guardian Ad Litem program. And then to Dan's right is Denise Herman, who is our fiscal analyst or accounting analyst, I believe. So she handles the money on the Guardian Ad Litem side. And if I need to get their assistance, I will request that of them. I would also tell members of the committee that Judge Sharp, the Honorable Judge Sharp from the Laramie County Judicial District, was here and was hoping to be here in support of us today, but had to leave due to his busy schedule.
He's not
not at all. They're not busy at all. So I guess what I would first like to do is just give you a brief summary of the three units that are within our budget book today. Unit one is actually the public defender. The public defender represents the criminally accused who can't afford to hire private attorneys. The public defender's office has been in an existence since 1978 in the state of Wyoming, and it's a statewide program. We have 14 trial offices around the state. We have 5 field offices that handle one county, and the remaining of our trial offices have to travel to different counties to provide services. The number of attorneys we can discuss in each of those field offices as we get to our exceptions requests, and, of course, I can answer specific questions at any time in that regard. The public defender's office is funded 85% by the general fund and 15% by the counties. And there's a formula that's that was sort of referred to in the Public Defender Act that the public defender's office and LSO and the budget office bills the counties every year for a total of 15% of our budget. Each year in the public defender's office, we count our cases. We count our cases by newly assigned cases per fiscal year. So on starting July 1st to June 30th, we have an in-house database where we track how many felonies, misdemeanors, and juvenile delinquencies that were assigned on the criminal side in the public defender's office. We based our requests and our exceptions requests based somewhat on those numbers, and we've adopted caseload standards that have helped us realize that the public defender's office is essentially in an ethical and a constitutional crisis. The public defender's office exists because the state of Wyoming must provide constitutionally effective assistance to counsel in state crimes where somebody's looking at the possibility of going to jail or going to prison. The second unit is the Guardian Ad Litem program. The public defender's office was given, if you will, the Guardian Ad Litem program in 2008. It was basically a session law and then was codified into official existence in 2012. The Guardian Ad Litem program is a little bit different than the public defender's office. The Guardian Ad Litem program is assigned to represent children in abuse and neglect cases, basically. Sometimes in juvenile delinquency cases, sometimes in CHINS cases, sometimes in appeal, and then in trial when the parent is parental rights are being terminated. The Guardian Ad Litem program is based and guided upon federal law and mandates, and then that those same mandates that the state of Wyoming requires of those attorneys who represent children in those cases. That program isn't mandated by the state or mandated by the Constitution. We kind of off the record discussed that, so I'll explain that now. Each county must provide a child, a guardian ad litem, in a case where they've been taken from the home or their parents have been accused of neglect or abuse. In 2008, the state of Wyoming decided to help fund that. So essentially the program is set up as such. If the county wants to participate in the Guardian Ad Litem program, they sign a memorandum of understanding with the Public Defender's Office Guardian Ad Litem Division. And what that allows the counties to do is to have the state of Wyoming pay for essentially 80% of those costs, and then the county matches that dollar amount about 20%. Or it is 20%. We could ask the counties to provide more, but that 80-20 has been essentially how we've outlined it to do.
Is that 80% statutory or by rule?
Mr. Co-Chair, if you're going to speak, please turn on your mic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, it is by statute.
Wow. Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So going back, the public defender split, is that statutory, the 85-15?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Schwartz, it is.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that, and I suppose maybe the guardian ad litem then too, is the county's portion determined on a population base or on the number of cases from that county, or is it just a reimbursement type system?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, it's reimbursement. It's our actual costs that we track. We also do track how many kids are represented per county, but it is based on our actual costs in those counties.
Follow up.
So a given county might end up only putting in I mean, the proportionally, the counties might not be the same because they have different demographics.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, that's true. And our caseloads in the Guardian Ad Litem program reflect the population of the state. Our biggest caseloads are in our most populated counties. So, yes, that's true.
Could I ask you to pull the mic closer to your mouth? You've got a very soft voice.
Well, I've never heard that.
At the moment, anyway. Representative Larson.
Thank you. On your guardian ad litem, the criteria for being a guardian ad litem, is that in statute or rule? And if a county does not participate, do they have to comply with that same rule that the state has? And then I'd like a follow-up after that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Larson, well, first of all, a guardian ad litem has to be admitted into the Wyoming Bar to practice law, so they have to be in good standing. And that holds true whether the county participates in the guardian ad litem program or not. There are some statutory requirements that we have of our guardian ad litem attorneys, but most of what our guardian ad litem attorneys' standard of care is outlined in our rules. If a county does not participate, such as Goshen County, they would not have to abide by those rules.
So then a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, has there been in the past, and if not, is there a willingness, as we see the tribes on the reservation now having in place a joint tribal law system but have not been providing guardian ad litems, has there been any talk in the past about helping them not with financially or providing bodies, but just in advice on how that's structured? And has there been any of that discussion? And if not, is there a willingness in that office to help them establish that rule and regulation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I don't believe that we've had those discussions, but we certainly would be willing to provide that. Right, Dan? Mr. Wild, we would. Whatever they would need from us, we would be glad to sit down with them.
Are there attorneys whose entire practice is as a guardian ad litem, you know, such as somebody who practices estate law, or does it tend to be, for a lot of attorneys, a mix of various things, including guardian ad litem?
Mr. Chairman, it's a mix. We have a handful of attorneys who do nothing but guardian ad litem work. We have some full-time employee attorneys, and we have mostly contract attorneys who are paid out of the 900 series who do guardian ad litem work, and there's a handful that are full-time contractors, but the majority of them do guardian ad litem work as part of their general practice.
Okay. Thank you. No more questions. Please move on.
Okay. And I think I've covered what I intended to cover briefly about the guardian ad litem program, and we do have some exceptions requests, so I can answer questions about that later on. And then the final unit is what we'll call the Eaton case. It's the court-ordered funding of a death penalty case. And that exception request, I can tell the committee right now, is just permission to carry over monies that we were funded from the last biennium. But the Public Defenders Act, when it was written in 1978, included provisions for a court to tell the Public Defender's Office that they had to pay for an attorney who didn't work for the Public Defender's Office, or that they had to provide expert services to a defendant who had hired private counsel but who had since become needy pursuant to the statute, and needy meaning too poor to hire a private attorney, essentially. Pursuant to those statutes, Mr. Eaton's death sentence was essentially reversed by the federal court and kicked back to Natrona County for a new trial. He's indigent. He doesn't have the ability to pay for capital case attorneys, and certainly capital cases cost more than any other type of case for many reasons. And so he requested through his federal habeas attorneys that the court ordered the Public Defender's Office to pay for that defense. And the overall commitment, they believe, will be $2.5 million. What we're looking at right now is a carryover of the $1,250,000 that was allotted for this last biennium. Okay.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we anticipate, are there any pending cases that could potentially be capital cases?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Schwartz, there are. Right now, we have one almost officially active capital case in Laramie County. We'll know February 1st if there's a capital case here in Laramie County. There are discussions from the Laramie County District Attorney's Office that another murder case might go capital. So right now, I believe we have one that's likely to go capital and one that could go capital.
Where are we at in the Eaton case?
Mr. Chairman, it's right now the Tenth Circuit has stayed everything. There's an appeal pending. There were a number of issues raised by the defendant and I think by the state who counter-appealed or vice versa. Right now, I believe Mr. Eaton's competency is being challenged, but I'm not exactly certain. The court ordered that my office not be given specific information about that case because our office was found ineffective in its representation of Mr. Eaton the first time around. So there's really a conflict of interest for us to be too involved. I know that just generally from the public record.
So now, who's defending him now?
An attorney out of Kansas City, Sean O'Brien, who represented him on his federal habeas appeal, and then local counsel is Terry Harris, and then another attorney, Lindsay Runnels, and I believe she's out of Kansas City also. They were appointed by the federal courts to do his federal habeas case and have been allowed to stay on to do his trial case.
And where does that money come from? Is that all federal money?
No. In fact, none of it is, Mr. Chairman. It's all from our budget. It all is from the
general
fund.
Comes out of your budget?
It comes out of our budget. Yep.
But you're not given any say in what attorneys or how many attorneys are hired?
No. Or how much hourly, how much they get paid per hour. Either. We also are paying for a mitigation investigation, a mitigation specialist, an investigator, and then down the road, if this goes to trial, we'll be ordered to pay for any experts that they may have. And it's just a sentencing rehearing. I should be clear about that. His guilt isn't being contested. It's just sentence now.
Oh, well, if it's just a sentencing hearing, it'd be cheap.
Right, just $2.5 million.
Okay. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the back of my mind is where's the justice for the state of Wyoming, but we can visit about that some other time. How much total, if not grand total, how much total in terms of what you oversee has that Eaton case cost the state of Wyoming? Do you have any idea? Do you have a total?
I do, Mr. Chairman. If I could just look at my... We anticipated this question, and I stuck it in my piles. It actually hasn't been a grand total of as much as you might think. They've billed about $155,000 so far.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm dating it all the way back. I mean, I'm just wondering in the back of my mind what over the last 30 years, 35 years, whenever that incident took place, for which he was found guilty. I wonder how much our
state
put into that case.
Okay. I understand now, Mr. Chairman and Senator Landon. Originally, the Public Defender's Office expended about $155,000when it was first tried in 2003. Since we've been ordered to pay pursuant to that other part of the Public Defender Act, they've billed about $278,000. So whatever that total is, that's about what it's cost the state of Wyoming on the public defender side. I don't know what it's cost the prison to house him and transport him. I don't know what it has cost the prosecution to prosecute him. I don't know what the costs were to Natrona County when they had the first trial. But certainly there's security costs. If the jury was sequestered, Natrona County had to pay for that. So we would have to go to the county and the prosecutors and even the attorney general's office to get their costs. But on the public defender side, those are the amounts that we could document have been spent.
And you said 2003. It feels like it was 50 years ago, but 2003 was the first involvement of the public defender's office.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess I would maybe want to look at Ryan. Do you know what time? Was it 2003 was the trial? Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, the trial did occur in 2003. And then we also represented Mr. Eaton on his direct appeal. And then I believe we paid for a state post-conviction, and then it went up to the federal courts. And I couldn't tell you what necessarily it cost us on appeal unless that's included in the $155,000. I don't think it is. I think those are just trial costs. We did hire experts on the appeal. We had to have a big hearing about whether or not the lawyers in the case did their job. So we had to have other lawyers and experts come in and talk about how it should have been done better. So I'm not sure that we could get those, though. We could get those costs.
I know,
to
this
the committee.
Is mostly a.
Okay.
I know this is mostly a budget committee, but I'm just wondering about the professional dilemma that it puts you in, as his defender, defending him when part of his argument is ineffective counsel. What's the official position that your office takes when they're making an argument like that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not just in capital case. We oftentimes have to raise ineffective assistance of counsel on ourselves. Our appellate division is part of the public defender's office, and so their job is to look at appeals, people who've been convicted after trial, sometimes after guilty pleas.
So it'd be one part of your office complaining, using the other part of your office as an excuse.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and I don't know if it's an excuse or not, but it certainly is a dilemma. Other states have handled this by allowing defendants to raise ineffective assistance of counsel on post-conviction and not direct appeal. In the state of Wyoming, if you don't raise it on direct appeal, then you've waived it. Colorado has what they call alternative defense counsel, so they essentially have two public defender's offices, so they're not all working together, and one side might look at the competency of the attorneys on the other side. But in Wyoming, we do raise it on ourselves. And in regard to the Eaton case, at the stage that we're at now, the federal court did say that we had a conflict of interest. So our objection to being ordered to pay for it was in part that, well, if we have a conflict of interest, then how can you make us pay for that? And we lost that, and Judge Forgy ordered us to pay.
Huh. All right. Let's move on.
Okay. And I guess I would direct the committee to page 7. Page 7 is our exceptions request priorities table. And then to go through the exceptions request, unless there were questions on our standard budget. And we're talking about, we'll start with the Public Defender's Office Unit 1 first. Generally, I would tell this committee that the standard budget as it is now is not sufficient for the Public Defender's Office to continue to provide legal counsel to all of the defendants that have been appointed to our office for representation in the upcoming biennium. And our exceptions requests reflect that deficiency, if you will. The Public Defender's Office has been functioning really at a bare bones level for at least a budget and a half. We certainly came before this committee for the 17-18 budget and expressed to this committee our belief that we would be unable to provide ethical representation to clients in several of our counties. So when a public defender attorney is assigned a case, they have to act like an attorney as if they were in a private case, in any kind of a case. And so a public defender attorney has ethical obligations that are exactly the same as every other attorney who practices law in the state of Wyoming. We public defenders are assigned cases on a rotation basis. A poor person gets accused of a crime. They ask the circuit court at their initial hearing to, they tell them, you know, that thing I hear on TV that says the state will provide my attorney. I want this court to do that for me in this case. They have to provide some financial information to the court. If the court finds that they can't hire a private attorney, our office gets appointed. And because we have those field offices, the courts send those cases to the field office secretaries, basically, who enter that information into a database, and then our supervisor assigns those cases. So a public defender attorney could get a mix of felonies, misdemeanors, and juvenile delinquencies on a daily basis, and certainly throughout the year would have a mix of those cases. We've tracked cases at least since Leonard Munker was the state public defender and probably before then. And it's always been a struggle for us to say to this committee or even to say to the governor, we're too busy. This feels too busy. It looks like caseloads are going up in Campbell County. It looks like caseloads are going up in Laramie County. And we could give you a number to do that. Well, Mr. Roden and I have struggled with that now for 10 years. And in 2014 and 15, we really decided we need to understand what that meant before we could express to anybody what it really is like to be a public defender attorney and what our resources really need to be. We started researching what the ABA has done in terms of excessive caseloads or workloads for public defender attorneys, and we researched what other states have done in adopting caseload standards. So in 2015, we adopted what we call the caseload standard, or caseload maximum standard, I guess is what we call it, and it's based on limits. So if an attorney were to get 150 felonies a year, and that's the only kind of case they did, that attorney could do no more cases to be ethical. If he only did misdemeanors, our standard is 400 misdemeanors a year.
Representative Schwartz.
Yeah, I was looking because it's felony, misdemeanor, juvenile. Mm-hmm. But there's no waiting because all felonies are not created mm-hmm. equal, and some can be extraordinarily time-consuming. You understand where I'm headed.
I do. Mr. Chairman and Representative Schwartz, I agree. We do also have an in-house case waiting system, and we use that system when we assign cases. So within our field offices, if I've got one felony attorney whose case wait includes a lot of, let's say, child sex cases, those have a high case wait, but somebody else is doing all the drug cases, then we can and sort of alternate that. But what we found, Representative Schwartz, is that most of the states just looked at the type of case and not necessarily the case weight, because there's so many variables that go into that. It could be the client. It could be that the client has mental illness, and so that makes a forgery case more difficult than a murder case sometimes. It could be that certain prosecutors prosecute types of cases differently. It depends on how much travel is involved. So we decided not to add the case weight to whether or not we could determine whether our attorneys are ethical, but we certainly do take that into account when we assign cases.
Please do.
So was that a factor in your prioritization of the various requests for additional defenders?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Schwartz, it was not. I would tell you that case weights are almost parallel to the number of cases. If you're so busy that you can't do the work, your case weight's pretty high anyway because you have too many cases. I would say that our busier offices tend to have the highest case weights. It tends to be more serious crime happening in those places, but it was not part of our decision making in this budget.
Mr. Co-Chair.
So, Diane, you know, I've always been a pretty big advocate of the public defender's office, mm-hmm. in part because I've been one.
Right.
But if you're adopting standards mm-hmm. and caseload rules, then it's kind of like, and if you violate them or if you're not following them, then you're, in essence, setting up a ineffective assistance of counsel time every time that happens. And so it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then it appears to be as if you're kind of feathering your own nest when you do it that way. And then when you're relying on the ABA guidelines and things like that, well, you know, the ABA has, and particularly the criminal division, has a particular bent to feather its own nest. And it clearly does, just like, and it has a political objective. It's not really a truly non-biased entity. And there are misdemeanor cases where you can literally finish, you can do 15 of them in one day, mm-hmm. fairly easily. And yet they, depending on the cases, but they don't all get dismissed right away. And so, That's the conundrum that I have is that, well, if you're, and it's different in every county and it works differently and part of the problem has a lot to do with how the particular prosecutor or district attorney runs the show that causes you more difficulty and actually courts as well. But it's just, to me, it's, the hard part is if when you say, okay, you get 11 cases for one of your part-time folks around, mm-hmm. and that's all you get. And if it may take three, or just to go through the sequences of getting that case settled or resolved, or going through the initial appearances and all that stuff, it just appears to me that you're kind of setting it up a little bit the way that it is. And to me, that's just a little frustrating. So that was my first question.
Okay.
And then one of the questions I'd like you to answer is I've heard that some of your contract attorneys aren't getting paid timely on their disbursement checks. And I just want to know if that's correct, and if so, why. or how those and how those checks get cut and are sent out. So just so I don't forget.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Chairman Nicholas, if I can answer the last question first because that's easier. Our contract attorneys have to turn in a voucher and an invoice by the first of every month, and they're paid by the 10th of every month. And that's standard. There's not a public defender attorney that I know of that hasn't been paid timely. Even if they don't give us their invoices in a timely manner, Ms. Meza and her staff are on them constantly in order to do that because we budget monthly, just like any other household. So I have not heard that. In terms of guardian ad litem attorneys, we have in the past, I don't know about recently, had guardian ad litem attorneys who just didn't bill us for 3 or 4 months. But when they get it to us, we pay them immediately, and we get them paid in the next SAO run as fast as we can.
Well, and Mr. Cochair, while we're on that, what I've seen is really a balloon in the cost of guardian ad litem costs. What type of mechanisms do you have to make sure that the appointed attorneys aren't spending, you know, a day and a half interviewing and re-interviewing and that type of stuff so that you monitor a reasonable cost for guardian attorney time?
Right. Mr. Chairman and Chairman Nicholas, our guardian ad litem attorneys are paid the same amount every month to handle a caseload. So they aren't billing us hourly any longer. So however long they interview their
clients. And I was thinking more of the contract ones.
Yeah, and that the contracts are the same. And we do the same on the public defender side. So a half a contract or a part-time contract in Laramie County on the public defender side is about $4,400 a month, and that's what they get paid. They get paid that amount no matter what. So we don't have hourly problems on either side. And we decided to do that with the guardian ad litem after we had hourly rates just kind of skyrocket and we had no ability to
do
that.
When did you do that?
We probably started doing that in 2010 or 2012, my best memory, is we quit doing that. It's the caseloads that are driving our costs in the guardian ad litem program, and those decisions are made by county attorneys and district attorneys' offices and out of our hands.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so then I haven't, Mr. Chairman, I haven't answered the Representative Chairman Nicholas's biggest concern about how we adopted those standards, and I think it's better if I just explain it a little bit better. So the ABA doesn't necessarily have guidelines. They haven't adopted a caseload standard. They've issued ethics opinions about what an excessive caseload looks like and what it shouldn't do. If it makes an attorney too busy to do the things they need to do for each client, then that's considered an excessive caseload and it might be unethical. We actually adopted our standards from a committee that studied public defenders' offices and hourly times in 1973. It's the NACC, and I'm not sure. I think I've referred to it in the budget book. I don't know what that stands for anymore. And then over time, public defenders' offices across the country have used those standards and done time studies, actual time studies, like how much time does it actually take to do a domestic violence case on average? And so rather than reinvent the wheel, we looked at Texas, we looked at Nebraska, we looked at Hawaii. Colorado did a time study based on the Delphi method, which is a really complicated system. And what we found was those NAC numbers play out. I mean, those really hold true. I would tell this committee, though, that Texas has decided that an attorney shouldn't handle more than 200 misdemeanors a year, and our standards are at 400. So really, Chairman Nicholas, what my concern is whether or not my attorneys can be ethical, not whether or not some court someday says they're ineffective. I don't know that a court would say if you're too busy, you're ineffective. It really comes down to that I have attorneys who, and we had an attorney write a letter to us, and it's in our handout, 008147PD, the ethics of a public defender attorney in Gillette, who is so overwhelmed in Gillette that he says, I can't even look at the discovery in a case. I haven't even read the police reports in most of my cases because I'm too busy. So it's not about us hoping that attorneys are found ineffective. I'll tell you that my trial attorneys hate when ineffective assistance of counsel is raised on them because their licenses are on the line. Their livelihood and standard of practice is in jeopardy when that happens. So I certainly don't want to cause a system that puts all of these attorneys' livelihood and professional standards on the line. What we need to do is to make sure that they're not in that situation anymore. So what we've done with these caseload standards is we had to do sort of a disjunctive formula. So all of our attorneys handle felonies, misdemeanors, and juvenile delinquencies. We plug those numbers in to how many, you know, what their full-time equivalent is, because I've got a lot of part-time public defender attorneys too. and we look at how many felonies, what's the percentage of their caseload is felonies, what percentage is misdemeanors, and what percentage is juvenile delinquencies. And those percentages added up should never get to 100%. 100% is maximum. 100% is that your nose is right above the water, and that's about it. You can breathe, but anything else happens, and you're going to drown in that situation. So what we've done in our exceptions request, and we prioritized it in our field offices who are the highest above 100%. So, for instance, exception request priority number one is for an attorney in our Hot Springs and Warland office. In that office, I only have 1.75 attorneys. So I have an employee who's a three-quarter time attorney, and then we have a contract that's a full-time contract.
Excuse me, Diane. We've got people listening on the internet who followed. So,
and I'm going too fast.
No, you're not going okay. too fast, but when you're getting to a specific point, like page. You are with this exception request, can you cite the page of the,
I
of
certainly
the
will.
Budget book?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. We are on page 15 right now. And so our public defender office in Warland and Thermopolis had a caseload maximum of 140%. So those attorneys are carrying a caseload 40% beyond what allows them to be ethical. And the reason we gave you the handout from the Gillette attorney is that that's what that looks like. If you have practiced law or you know anybody who practices law, when you have on average 300 cases a year, and it's not just cases, it's clients that you have to meet with, it's police reports that you have to meet with. In a felony case, you're going to court at least four times, sometimes closer to 10. You have to prepare for trial in a small percentage of our cases. You're just unable to do that work. When we adopted these caseload standards, we started talking to bar counsel, Mark Gifford, and we have worked with him closely to determine whether or not he agrees that this really does make somebody unethical. And by unethical, we mean that our attorneys can't provide competent counsel. They can't provide that counsel in a diligent manner. And essentially, they maybe have a conflict of interest, because when an attorney has a caseload that's 40% too big, they're really choosing between cases and clients. So I'm probably going to pay more attention to my murder client than I am to my forgery client than I am to my domestic violence client. But that's not what the Constitution guarantees to the domestic violence client or the forgery client. And it's not what the ethical rules say. The ethical rules don't say you have to do all of these things or else, unless you're a public defender attorney. The ethical rules don't say, as a client, you're entitled to this type of representation unless you're too poor to hire a private attorney in a criminal case. So what we decided based on these ethics things was we looked at each of these places and plugged in what would these caseload standard maximums do if we plugged in one attorney. And in a couple of our acceptance requests, as you see when we get to Campbell County, it doesn't even really bring it back down to 100%, but it helps out a lot. We took the number of cases in Warland in fiscal year 17. We took 40% of that, and that amounts to 284 cases a year. We've met with the judges and the Supreme Court, and they are supportive of this result if we are not given the assistance through this budget process that we require. That
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, so I'm trying to understand the numbers. So
okay.
The first thing I was looking at was the caseload that's on 9 and 10, which is under the Office of Public Defender. At least that's the way I'm reading it.
Caseload and 9 and 10, what, priority 9 and 10? Or
no, page 9 and 10 had
okay.
a caseload
so we know what
for
we're talking
2016,
about.
2017.
Yeah.
Those have no – those don't speak at all to the numbers of that you just mentioned on page – 15.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Sumners, those are guardian ad litem numbers. That's a chart that we had to provide for the budget processes and also a chart. So that's the guardian ad litem office, not the public defender's office. And we don't have a chart that lists out the cases for each field office, and we can get that to this committee, and we can get that to this committee this afternoon if we need to. The public defender's office represented 15,975 clients in fiscal year 17.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest if we have to defend this kind of an increase mm-hmm. on the floor, we need mm-hmm. to see the caseload that we're talking about.
Don't
this
you?
Increase.
We already have a handout.
And we have a handout.
We have a handout? Okay.
Yes, it's a handout, Joint Appropriation 116. agency OOH.
Mr. Chairman, I would say we could give the committee even more information than this. On the left-hand side is just the number of cases that we provide a representation to. It doesn't include the number of cases each of these counties on the right-hand side represented. What it includes is the number of cases we will not provide attorneys to if we are not given an attorney in those offices. So we could get a chart that
Mr. Co-Chair.
Is more specific.
On this list, it mm-hmm. would be helpful to know how many let me ask you, you have cases per year. Does that include that total number, the total amount of charges? So if you have one person that has seven crimes and he's violated and has been charged with three different misdemeanors and three felonies, are those all stacked, or there's some way that you combine those so we know the actual number of personnel? And
Mr. Chairman, there is. What we do is we end up getting a packet from the court, and the packet either has an information with felony charges, and that's one case, no matter how many counts. We add a case weight if there's more than one count to a felony case. And misdemeanors are often charged 7 or 8 tickets at a time. When they come over to us as one case, we count that as one case. But then a case weight is added because there's subcases to those. So if there's a DUI and a speeding, but it's one case
per these. What is the case weight? How do you do that? Does it turn into the equivalent of 2 or 3? Or
no.
If you have 7?
No, and that, no, Mr. Chairman, that case weight is just for in-house purposes for us to look at. In Laramie County, for instance, I've got 4 attorneys who just do misdemeanor cases, and then we watch that case weight to make sure that we don't have one person doing more domestic violence cases than property cases.
And then, Mr. Co-Chair, how do you deal with, you know, driving with suspended license? I mean, you know, those misdemeanors are some things that either, you know, either you're pregnant or you're not kind of a thing. So it doesn't really take a lot of time and effort to do
right.
it. So, I mean, do you weight those at all, or how do you?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's a type of felony that I can't remember exactly what our case weight is. It's, I think, maybe worth 3 points on our case weighting system, and a murder case is worth 100. So within our case weight, that doesn't count. Very, very rarely, I would tell you anecdotally, do we just get a DUS case. That DUS is usually connected to a DUI or a possession case, or a DUI and a possession case. So it's rarely just a DUS. I would guess that we are very rarely representing people who just have DUS tickets. Those people most likely are pleading guilty without the assistance of counsel at their initial appearances. That would be a rare case for us.
Thank you.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Can I go back to statutory 80-20-85-15 split?
Right.
What comes to mind when we're describing situations in Washakie County or Campbell County, are counties prohibited from calling you up and saying, we want to buy some more attorney time so that we can help our public defender's office? I mean, are counties allowed to step up and help us in this? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chairman, I would say the answer to that is no. The Public Defender Act just says 85% general fund and 15% to the counties, and it's proportioned out to the 23 different counties. There is no provision in the Public Defender Act that allows or requires the counties to participate beyond that 15%. They do have to provide office space. But that's it. So there is no mechanism in the Public Defender Act to do that. In the Guardian Ad Litem Act, there is provisions because we could ask the counties to start paying a bigger share, and if they agreed to do that, they could. But the Child Protection Act requires the county to pay for it. So we don't have that sort of safeguard in the Public Defender Act at this time, and haven't since 1978.
Follow up?
Thank you for that answer. Mm-hmm. I, you know, in the back of my mind is this whole notion of incentives on the part of the county to do some things to, you know, to help the state. Where's the incentive to try to curb some things if the county? In other words, we've got probably 20 counties that are subsidizing counties that are really having the most difficulties right now, and so. I don't have any answers to that, but that's what swirls around in your mind when you have a situation that, you know, we only have to pay the 15%, and that's it.
And, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with that. You know, we certainly feel that it would be helpful in some way to have another source of funding, but that's, you know, that's not for us to decide. But the public defender's hands were tied to that, that formula.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, looking at the handout that there you had on the caseload history, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure you probably weren't there in 1983,
no.
So I'm just asking sort of, you know, your sense. I mean, obviously the population hasn't multiplied by five in that time. Would you say that the cases per year is tracking pretty evenly with the increase in the crime rate in general, or would you say that the cases per year is maybe, you know, that the curve is going up because the poverty rate is higher, or is there something in the language as far as who is eligible for the services that is enabling a higher percentage of people to qualify for the service?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, that's a complicated question, and some of it I would just have to answer anecdotally. I don't know if there's a correlation to the crime rate or not. I'm assuming that there is. Certainly district attorneys and prosecuting attorneys make those decisions and charge crimes, whether that, you know, crime rate has gone up or not. I think that the increase from 16 to 17 was a pretty marked increase, in my opinion. And it's where we started feeling the crunch that, you know, clients are complaining to judges. Judges are having to visit with attorneys about whether they have enough time to do their cases and those kinds of things. I really think it's just the people who qualify to be a public defender. The Public Defender Act talks about what that means. But then the Wyoming Supreme Court adopted Rule 44, and Rule 44 outlines what indigency means. And indigency, by the way, isn't a word that pops up on any word processor that I know. It's just in Rule 44. And it's basically an affidavit that somebody fills out to determine, and they have to list all their assets and their income and then what their debts are. And they also, it's pretty detailed, like, you know, what are your clothes worth? Do you own a car? Can you trade that in? Do you own any property that you can sell? Do you have friends and family who can help you hire in a private attorney? And I would tell this committee, and you specifically, Representative Wilson, that I think we need to do a better job at screening who qualifies to be a public defender. And I've met with the district court judges in their meetings and the circuit court judges, and I've sent out letters, and we've adopted an affidavit that I think does a better job at that. And we've also adopted a public defender fee schedule so that my attorneys are asking for more consistent fees that public defender clients can be ordered to repay at the back end. That all goes back to the general fund, but it's certainly something we've done. Other states have a more complicated process of determining who qualifies. They do like 120% of the poverty level and those kinds of things, but that usually requires a whole nother office to do that, and that's just, I don't think we have the resources or the ability to do that. My public defenders have an ethical obligation to tell a court that they think somebody makes too much money. And so we go in and we ask courts and say, hey, this guy makes more money than I do. I don't think the state of Wyoming should be giving him a lawyer. And that happens, believe it or not. And so our judges, have agreed to do a better job and are starting to do a better job. Prosecutors and judges at that initial hearing can decide whether or not somebody's actually going to go to jail. And if they're not going to go to jail, they don't qualify for a public defender, in Wyoming. I also think that, you know, it seems like every year there's a new crime. There's a strangulation statute. There's an enhancement on something else.
Yeah.
And, right.
We're creating new crimes.
Okay. You said that. I didn't. but it certainly does mean that people, are in more need of an attorney. So, whether or not poverty's gone up, whether or not the population has increased, or whether or not the crime rate has gone up, it's certainly something that's out of our hands because the court tells us we have to do it, and we have to do it.
A certain proportion of your clients are criminals. Subtle here, am I? So well,
they're all accused criminals.
So
for sure.
In fact, what is the penalty for lying to your public defender about your capability to pay or how poor you are?
Mr. Chairman, and it's not really – it's not to the public defender. They fill out an affidavit where they've taken an oath to tell the truth, so they could be charged with perjury.
But they're already criminals, so, you know, lying is –
I guess I don't have an answer for
so
that.
Is there uh-huh. a penalty? So if it's found that they've lied about their resources, mm-hmm. is there a criminal penalty for that?
Yeah, they can be charged with perjury, and that has happened. I've seen it maybe two or three times in
Who's
the 23 years
them?
I've done that. Well, that's a good question. I think what happens is the court orders me to pay a private attorney to do that case. The Public Defender Act allows for that, so that has happened. But I would tell the court that, you know, I have been doing this for 23 years. I've done every kind of case from a DUI to a capital murder case, and I've done appellate work. So essentially I've done it all, and most of my clients really can't afford an attorney. Most of my clients don't even know how to live effectively in the world today. And yeah, they are committing crimes and they're being charged with those crimes. But certainly
well,
the vast majority
guilty.
Are poor.
I said a portion yeah. of them are. I'll give you the benefit of the
okay.
doubt.
Okay. Okay. I'll take that.
I gave you an
I'll
out
take
there.
That.
Let's say 98% of them are innocent.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So this handout
mm-hmm.
doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Okay.
So I don't know if the number of cases unable to handle. You already gave it in the budget book. You say 100% of we're at 110% of maximum caseload.
Right.
So that 4,000 number, if that's a yearly number on 2017, makes no sense on the 15,000. So that 4,000 is created some other way than based upon your maximum caseload, I'm assuming.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Summers, it is still based on the caseload maximum, so we track it for the entire agency, and our agency is at 111%, 112% of caseload maximum. But then we also track it per field office. And so the chart that you have is per those field offices. So, for instance, Hot Springs County is at 140% of caseload maximum, and Campbell County is at 129%, I believe, caseload maximum, and then on down. I believe Natrona County is at 109% caseload maximum, and so that's how we came up with those numbers. So we're looking at it at a field office basis because the way our field offices are set up, I can't borrow attorneys from other field offices to come and help them because they're saturated. We have some field offices who are at 80% of caseload maximum. One of those offices is Park County, but Park County has to be in Cody and Powell and Basin all in one day, and then they handle with overflow and some conflict cases in Washakie County. And so I thought about that very instance and thought, well, what if I take an attorney out of Cody and put them in Hot Springs, Washakie County? What does that do? Well, it fixes Hot Springs, Washakie County, and it puts Cody at 102% of caseload maximum, so I haven't solved that issue. So that's why there's it looks like 112% for the agency, which it is, but for each field office is not.
So just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, if you could get a sheet that just shows by field office what the percentage is so I can relay it back to
we absolutely will, and I have a copy right here that I can at least give to for somebody to make copies when we end today. I do have that chart.
Diane, I have another question. Mm-hmm. Most of your exception requests are for additional attorneys.
Right.
And the pay is the same on all of them. It's $85,000 a year,
right?
Plus benefits of $30,000 a year. How was that figure arrived at? And the other question I had is, for the attorneys that you hire, is there a set hourly fee that you pay them?
Mr. Chairman, the state system has a classification of attorneys. So there's attorney 1, 2, 3, 4, and I think we only have 1, attorney 5, and that's the person who does the capital cases. And so attorney level 3 is really a journeyman level attorney who can handle any kind of regular case that happens every day in the public defender's office. So we base those figures on what an attorney level 3 would be paid. And HR gave us those figures based on what the average pay is to somebody who's a level 3 attorney. And a level 3 attorney is somebody who's practiced law for more than 5 years.
And that's the $85,000 plus the $30,000 per year.
And I don't know that it's $85,000 a year for...
Well, you're asking for 170. Right. Actually, it's more than that. It's almost $171,000 for the biennium. That works out to 85.5 a year.
I think we figured benefits, Mr. Chairman, more about 40%.
No, on top. Well, the benefits okay. are on top of that. There's almost 62,000.
62. Okay. My fiscal person says you are right, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
And what's the hourly rate that you pay, or is that based on whoever you hire?
Mr. Chairman, it's a salary for attorneys, and so we could break it down to hourly, but it's salary.
I'm talking about when you hire outside counsel to fill in.
When we do a professional contract with somebody, we don't do an hourly rate. We base it on what percentage of caseload they have, and then we factor in the years of experience that they have. So we have a chart of how we pay our public defender contractors. So a part-time attorney, generally, if somebody who's practiced less than 5 years, would make about $4,400 a month from the public defender's office to handle half a caseload wherever they are. And then a full-time person is $8,600 a month is what they would pay. And then, of course, they have to pay their own taxes and whatnot out of that, and they don't get benefits. So okay. We don't have an hourly rate. We have a set every month. This is what you get for this amount of cases.
So if I can follow up on that.
Please do.
So I'm curious on your request, how many full-time positions are you requesting versus half-time or three-quarter-time? Because they're a little bit less expensive.
They are, Chairman Nicholas. We asked for 8 full-time because when we plug in a full-time person, that's what brought down our maximums from above 100% to either close to 100% or below that. Certainly, we would work with whatever amount we were given.
So, you know, if you have 80%, someone who's 80% in Powell, but you got 110 in Washakie, say, it makes more sense to fill that with a part-time position than it does a full-time position in that type of instance. So have you done that analysis to figure out exactly have the right people in the right place as opposed to just 8 full-time positions?
We have, and our exceptions request reflects that we need at least 1 full-time attorney in each of those places. And I know if we hired somebody who was 3-quarter time, they would still get full benefits, so the salary would go down, but the benefits package would be the same.
And we don't have the graduation of pay increases that a full-time does.
No.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Almost as bad as poor Department of Ag. Are you able to do tele-attorney to save on in-state travel and maybe wear and tear? How does that work out as far as, you know, your obligation to represent people?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we can appear by video on some hearings. The rules of criminal procedure talk about what hearings we can do those in, but the attorney and the defendant have to be okay with it. I would tell you that it would be very difficult for me to represent somebody in a hearing where there was anything substantial going on if I wasn't sitting next to them, because if they have questions of me or they start blurting out something I don't want them to, it's difficult. But we can do arraignments by video conference, and I know a lot of the district court judges are starting to do that. And Judge Tyler really wanted to implement something that was more effective for his area of the neck of the woods up in Pinedale and Jackson. So there are ways that we can do that, and we try to do it as much as we can.
Is there anybody here from the Oil and Gas Commission? We'll take you up at 1 o'clock instead of making you sit here for no good reason.
Want
to take a break now? All right. And co-chair has asked that we take a short break for about 5-6 minutes. The plan here is to finish up with Ms. Lozano before lunch, and then we'll take up the Oil and Gas Commission at 1 o'clock. They shouldn't take long.
Okay.
Ms. Lozano, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just briefly, I handed Representative Larson my chart that I referred to, that's caseloads, and it has my notes, so you could ignore those notes, but we have 2 sheets that we handed out that looks at just total caseload with our FTE per field office, and then how many cases per attorney or in that field office. And the next one is the one that reaches the caseload maximum percentages. And I think we should probably provide this committee with a written form of what that formula looks like. So we'll get that to the committee today. So I guess we have a lot of exceptions to go through. So I would like to start on page 15 is the
So just before we go on.
Mr. Co-Chair.
And Diane, so if we come up with a number to give you as opposed to positions, you know, you take your total exception request and say, and if we say, okay, we'll give you half. And then we let you decide the most appropriate place to put it based upon the way you've got this. Is that something you can work with?
Mr. Chairman, it is.
Okay.
Well, it would work better than not giving anything.
Yeah.
Well, I would agree with that. And essentially, I think that that's what the governor's recommendations reflect.
Yeah. Okay.
you know, we've got half the attorneys and half the legal assistants we've given, and we can help out at least 8 of the 9 offices. So I think that that would be fair.
All right.
And so briefly, exception number request is for a practicing attorney 3 in Hot Springs and Washakie County. Per our caseload maximums, they're our busiest office. Ethically speaking, we'd be unable to provide representation in 568 cases without assistance there. The governor did recommend, did approve this recommendation.
All right. Priority 2.
Priority 2 is for the appellate division, and I'm not going to bother this committee with how we decide how many appeals an appellate attorney has, but we've requested an attorney level 3 attorney in the appellate office. Also, the governor has approved this recommendation.
Priority 3.
Same request in Campbell County. Campbell County is second as far as our caseload maximums. They're third as far as total cases per county, but they're the county that would cost the most if we couldn't add an attorney there. We'd have to kick back 1,100 cases. The governor has approved this recommendation or this request. Sorry.
Let me ask you a quick question. You're asking for a attorney practicing attorney 3. In Hot Springs, you know, over in the basin, and also for Campbell County, but the for the appellate attorney, you're asking for the same thing, and it would seem to me that an appellate attorney would, from my understanding, is basically a higher level than the other two.
Right, Mr. Chairman, and we probably should ask for a level 4 attorney. All my appellate attorneys right now are level 4, so they've been practicing for more than 8 years. And so we probably should hire a more qualified attorney in that position.
Could it also be argued that you could get a practicing level 2 in the basin in Campbell County?
We could, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and just, Mr. Co-Chair, in some instances, and there's quite a few instances where appellate work is easier than trial work. And so your assumption that they're more experienced or something isn't really accurate. I mean, you can have brand new attorneys in the Attorney General's office doing appellate work, and they haven't practiced for more than 6 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's a wide variety of qualifications and skill levels in the appellate work as well.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's a fair assumption. And we have a new lead appellate counsel, Kirk Morgan, who would probably tell this committee that if he didn't get an attorney, he'd rather have a legal assistant to help them out. So we would make those decisions if we were given some amount of positions to do that on. Okay, then moving on to exception number 4 on page 18, we've requested an attorney level 3 in our trial office that's based in Douglas that covers Converse, Goshen, Niobrara, and Platte counties. And the governor does recommend approval of this exceptions request.
Okay, now we get interesting with priority 5.
We do. On page 19, priority 5 is the same request for Albany County. Albany County is one of my offices that's really shot up recently as far as caseloads. We've actually added a half-time attorney there. We have 2.5 attorneys in Albany County, and it just seems to get busier and busier. We feel the need is the same there. The governor has recommended denial of this exception request.
Let me ask you a quick question. We had District Attorney Sandberg in here.
Uh-huh.
Sandberg?
Right.
In here. Can't remember when, but and the number of cases in Laramie County in the southern tier bordering Colorado has shot up quite a bit.
Right.
And he blamed the legalization of pot in Colorado that has caused a spillover here. From your experience, are you seeing the same thing, or are you seeing the same cause?
Mr. Chairman, I do think we get quite a few cases on the I-80 corridor, whether it's marijuana or meth or any other kind of drug case. I actually just think it's the location of the highways here, I-80 and I-25. We see as many meth cases on I-80 and I-25 as we do marijuana cases.
Yeah, except that I-80 and I-25 have always been here.
Right.
But the number of cases have increased. So I'm trying to see if there's some sort of uniformity of opinion on why the number of cases have shot up in this
right, Mr. Chairman,
state.
I really don't know. Laramie County is the one that's increased the most, and it's probably not drug cases that have increased the most. We have an increase in violent crime in Laramie County. We have 6 or 7 more homicides in Laramie County this year than we did all of last year. So I don't know what the answer is. I Okay. I don't really have an opinion on
that's
that.
That's actually a good explanation. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
I think it's broadband.
Broadband, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is.
The radio waves are permeating.
Okay, then our exceptions request number 6 on page 20 is the same request for our office in Weston and Crook County. And that's an interesting office that only has one attorney, so the numbers are a little bit skewed there. But I have that one attorney who has to travel between two counties. We believe that we need an attorney, or at least a part-time attorney, as Chairman Nicholas recommended, even a part-time contract, which we didn't lay out in this request, would help us there. But the governor recommended denial of this exception request. And then the same for priority number 7, exception request for an attorney in Sweetwater County. The governor denied, recommended denial of that exception request. And then the same again on page 22 for the exception request for an attorney in Laramie County.
So just for clarification and in, I guess, partial defense of the governor, he's not saying, yes, I pick Campbell County and the Northern Basin and I reject these other counties.
No.
He's just saying, I'm giving you half of what you're asking for.
Mr. Chairman, that's how I read it, and we
okay,
did have
so
discussions.
So he's not being specific in the counties he's rejecting?
No, the discussions we've had with the governor's office was how would we prioritize it? If we got 4 attorneys, where would we put them? If we got 4 legal assistants, where would we put them?
Okay.
So essentially along the same lines as the question that Chairman Nicholas asked.
All right.
And then priority number 9 is the same request for an attorney county in Casper, and again the governor recommended denial of that exceptions request. On page 24, priority number 11 is an exception request. We asked for a legal assistant for each one of these offices that are busy. In that ABA ethics opinion that I discussed, there is discussion about, you know, the more support staff you have, the better lawyering you can do. In fact, maybe you can have too many cases, but if you have an adequate support staff, you can handle a little bit more than you could on your own. And the governor recommended that we get 4 of the 9 that we requested.
All right.
Okay, and then on to page 26 is our request for capital case funding. And we've talked a little bit about capital cases with Eaton, so I'll attempt to be brief. But the United States Supreme Court and the Wyoming Supreme Court require that defense attorneys do a lot more in capital cases, so it ends up costing us a lot more. We have to abide by the ABA guidelines for appointment and performance of defense counsel in death penalty cases. This is a one-time funding that we've been asking for, I think, since 2003 and 4, not when I was the director. So whatever monies we don't use in this series, we would, you know, has to be returned back to the state. And this money can only be used in capital cases. This money is used to hire mitigation investigation personnel and then experts in our capital cases. We requested $1 million. That request also includes we have to train our attorneys. One of the reasons the Eaton case got kicked back by the federal court was that one of the attorneys hadn't received adequate training. So we need to set aside monies to train our attorneys. And our attorneys have to, first of all, I would never make anybody do a capital case. But an attorney who qualifies as a level 4 attorney has done some capital cases, has to get trained every 2 years. So that money is reflected in there. And the governor recommended $500,000 split by the 85-15%, which I haven't been saying.
Let me ask you a question there. If the attorney has to have had experience in the capital case, otherwise the case could get booted, how do you get that experience without having the case booted in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, I might have misspoken. You don't necessarily have to have experience in a capital case. You have to be able to try a complex case, whether it's a homicide case or a sexual abuse type of case. Our in-house standards require that one person who's done a capital case be on that team. You have to have 3 attorneys on a capital case, by the way, or 2 attorneys on a capital case. So yeah, I don't know how you get there. Luckily, right now, luckily, if you will, I guess you could take that either way. I've got 4 attorneys who have done capital cases, including myself. So right now, we would be covered, okay, as far as that goes.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, if I heard you correctly earlier, you said there's a potential to have 2 more capital mm-hmm. cases coming up in the almost immediate future. Have you projected what the impact to your services will be if that happens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, we have looked at what that would cost us. I believe that our budget this last year was $500,000, which is what the governor recommended for 1920. And so far, if we ended up with two capital cases, that $500,000 is not likely going to cover that, those two cases. And so then we're left with either coming in at supplemental or requesting a B-11 or telling a court, hey, guess what? We can't represent this guy anymore because we don't have the funding to do it.
Follow up. So if, hypothetically, the Wyoming legislature got rid of the death penalty, you could use that money for other purposes within your budget, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, or this committee could use that for another reason, for another purpose in another agency. Right.
So when is it questioning and when is it lobbying?
I assume you don't want an answer for that, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
Okay. And as I said, the governor recommended half of our request to do that, and that's been funding that we've received from this committee since we've been asking for it. Exception priority number 13, public defender technology needs, on page 26 and then on to 27 and 28. I don't know why that's done that. But we need to replace laptops and computers. Warranties are out. The governor recommended that we get the equipment that we requested, but then denied our request for the data services and telecommunications. And I believe those are more connected to having the ability to purchase equipment that enables us to have internet access in all of our courthouses in the state of Wyoming. We can't always get internet. But the governor recommended denial of those, and we can live with the governor's recommendations as far as our technology needs go.
And I think the court systems are gearing that up so that it will be available in the courthouses. Okay.
And I believe so, too, Mr. Chairman. We just don't know when.
We gave them the money to do it.
Okay, good. Yeah. So maybe we have a better idea.
And an extra judge yesterday.
I heard, which makes Laramie County even more busy for the public defender's office here. But we certainly need it in Laramie County, so we like that recommendation. And then on to the Guardian Ad Litem program. The exceptions request start on page 36. And this is a weird exceptions request, but the only way to do it was that the standard budget didn't properly, I guess, figure out the split between the general fund and the special revenue funding from the counties. And the only way to fix it is to reduce the standard budget by $32,334, and that comes to you as an exceptions request. And I believe the governor approved that that request as well. And then the Guardian Ad Litem case management system is priority number 14 on page 36, and the governor approved that one-time exception request so we could finish our in-house case management system in the Guardian Ad Litem program. The final exceptions request for the Guardian Ad Litem program is on page 37, and it is the Section 320 reduction. The Public Defender's Office, we've decided to reduce the Guardian Ad Litem budget to meet the 320 requirements. And essentially what that means is that if the Guardian Ad Litem program were to lose that amount of money, we would be unable to provide representation to anywhere from 80 to 140 children, depending on where the location is and depending on how many, the type of case that it is. And the governor recommended approval of that exception request.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then what happens? I mean, the children are still there, so does this go back onto the counties then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, it does go back to the county. Unlike the Public Defenders Act, that doesn't keep the counties involved once the Public Defender's Office is involved in child abuse neglect cases. Ultimately, the county does have to provide that. Okay, and then on our Unit 4, page 40, which is the court-ordered Eaton case, as I've stated before, this exception request is just a request to carry over the monies that haven't been spent from 17-18 into the 19-20 budget, and I think we've given the figures as to what that looks like at this point in time, and the governor did also recommend approval of that request.
Questions? Seeing none.
Okay.
Anything else?
I would just add that I thank you for your time. wish that we had given you better charts. Representative Summers, if you want something that's even a little bit more simplified, we can get that to you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll need that too.
Okay.
This one's a little more complicated.
Okay, I will get something that makes a little bit more sense on one piece of paper to this committee this afternoon. And certainly the Public Defender's Office is an agency that, the state's required to provide the services that the Public Defender's Office does provide. We certainly wouldn't ask this committee or the governor for the help that we did unless we really truly believed that we needed it. I've been the director for 10 years, and I can tell this committee that, at least on the public defender side, we are really at what I would characterize as a constitutional crisis as far as the number of attorneys that I have to represent, the number of people that the courts are ordering us to provide counsel to.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
I guess a professional question. Mm-hmm. Under current Wyoming statute for death penalty, the primary form of execution is lethal injection. But there has been an ongoing shortage of the drugs to be able to do it. So under Wyoming statute, the secondary form of execution is gas chamber, which we don't have.
Right.
Is that grounds for trying to deny a death penalty case, the fact that we don't, the state currently doesn't have the means to execute?
Mr. Chairman, it's certainly something I would litigate if I were representing somebody in that very situation. And I might be active in a case this year, and we have talked about it.
That's cruel and unusual.
Right.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, somebody brought up a different bill in that regard. What happened to that bill?
It was visionary, and it passed the Senate, and it got to the House, and the House screwed around with it so much to the point that by the time it came out of the House, you could not execute. It was going to be a firing squad bill, uh-huh. And by the time you put the person in front of the firing squad, they had to be sedated to the point of unconsciousness. And if you had the drugs to do that, you could have just executed him that way anyhow.
That was my amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I knew it was something. I mean, I knew it was something that went wrong.
Well, as a lawyer in that case, I'd have to look at the Eighth Amendment and decide what I thought from there.
Yeah, I thought it was giving you a loophole to drive a truck through.
Huge loophole, yes.
Well, all right.
I was protecting the Eighth Amendment.
Yeah.
You were too. I agree.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
Appreciate it. Well, it looks like we could have done the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission after all. But instead, we'll get an extra 15 minutes in our lunch hour. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock.